I'd like to call the meeting to order and welcome everybody here today. And would the clerk call the roll, please?
Here. Commissioner Shajian.
Present.
Commissioner Blank.
Here.
Commissioner Berg.
Present.
Commissioner Waiso.
Here.
Commissioner Cram.
Here.
Commissioner Neely.
Here.
Commissioner Schoenbaum.
Here.
Commissioner Wan.
Here.
Chairman Kruer.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you very much. At this time, I'll go to Ms. Saab to make announcements and any changes to today's agenda and the procedures for today's hearing.
Yes, good morning, Chairman Kruer, commissioners, and members of the public. If you wish to address the commission today, we ask that you fill out a speaker slip. They can be found out on the table outside the hearing room. Please put your name and item number on the speaker slip. Bring it up to the staff table, and we'll pass it out to the chairman. He'll recognize you prior to that item being heard. We also ask that while in the hearing room that all cell phones be turned off. And turning to the agenda changes, on page 10 of the agenda, there are no changes. On page 11, items 7A and 7B are postponed. On page 12 of the agenda, item 8A, the Doge project is postponed. On item 8B, on page 12, the Coronado Beach Gate 60777 would move to consent. Item 11, the cease and desist order number CCC07NOV10 is withdrawn. On page 13 of the agenda, there are no changes. And on page 14 of the agenda, item 19A, the consistency certification for the transportation corridor is postponed.
On that item, Mr. Chairman, I might point out that we have had discussions with the transportation agency, and they have agreed, and we have agreed to the postponement to the February meeting. That's in San Diego, I believe, February. So that's when it's going to come back.
I agree with you, Mr. Douglas, and that's my understanding too. And I appreciate all the work you did on that to try to get both sides together and give everybody enough time. And I do appreciate it.
Okay. And the next item is 3A. These are the consent calendar items for the San Diego District. These are the items that are originally scheduled on the consent calendar. We're not aware of any opposition, and the conditions are acceptable to the applicants. Therefore, staff recommends the commission approve the consent calendar.
Do I have a motion?
Move the second.
Moved by Commissioner Waiso, second by Commissioner Kajian. Is there any objection to unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the consent calendar is unanimously approved.
Mr. Chairman, I forgot to mention earlier that we will need a closed session today, so my suggestion would be that we do that either at the end of the regular agenda or before break for lunch. My guess is we'll be able to finish.
My sense is that we'll be done by lunchtime today, so with this agenda, because we're starting so early, so some of us will be asleep by that time, but no. I'm speaking for myself. You know.
And because we don't have the item that would have taken 8 or 9
that's
hours.
That's correct. And right. And again, you cannot predict those things. And anyway, we.
Right.
So that's fine. We'll have a closed session.
Okay, thank you. And then the next item is item 4. This is the Deputy Director's report for the San Diego District. It's the list of waivers and non-material amendments. There are only 2 regular waivers and 1 non-material amendment to report today. We're not aware of any opposition to these items, and we recommend that the commission concur with the executive director's determination and approve the deputy director's report.
Is there any objection to finding concurrence with the executive director's determination? Hearing none, the commission concurs.
And item 5 are the items moved by staff from the regular calendar on today's agenda to the consent calendar. There is only 1 item. It's item 8B, 60777, the Coronado Beach Vehicle Gate. Again, we are not aware of any opposition to this matter. If there's anyone in the audience that is here to speak on this item, they should come forward now.
There is one speaker Ms. Sarb, I just want to ask, I think you're here just, you're in favor of the project, or you're just here. Mr. Cecil?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Cecil? I'm just here to represent the project, City of Coronado, had any questions.
Okay, very good. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, as where the conditions are acceptable to the applicant, we therefore recommend the commission approve this item on the consent calendar.
Commissioner Wiesel?
Yes, so moved.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner Wiesel, seconded by Commissioner Akajian. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission unanimously approves the consent item on the consent item 8B.
Next item is item 6A. The City of Carlsbad LCP amendment number 306, Poinsettia Place. This is an amendment to both the land use plan and the implementation plan that would change the land use designations and zoning on a 20.4-acre site in Carlsbad. It is a project-specific LCP amendment to accommodate subdivision of the site into two residential lots that would ultimately hold a total of 90 residential units. And due to the proximity of the subdivision to wetlands on the site, the City of Carlsbad's decision to approve the residential development would be appealable to the commission. Before the commission today is the change of the land use designation from residential low and medium density to residential high and medium density and open space. The corresponding zone change would be from LC or limited control, which is essentially an open space holding zone, to residential multiple and open space. The property was subject to review by the commission previously in its review of the Carlsbad Habitat Management Plan LCP amendment. And in the commission review of the Habitat Management Plan, habitat areas in this Zone 21 were of primary interest, and the standards were established that would be applicable to future development of specific sites, such as this one. The purpose of the standards is to identify those areas that are suitable for development and those areas that should be preserved as open space to establish contiguous habitat preserve and connectivity to the surrounding biological core and linkage areas. In this particular case, the future extension of Poinsettia Lane as a circulation element road across the site was recognized, and the standard limits the development to 25% of the property, not including the Poinsettia Lane construction, with the development to be clustered along the disturbed portions of the northern extent of the property adjacent to Cassia Road and the future extension of Poinsettia Lane. The standard further indicates that impacts to Southern Maritime Chaparral shall be minimized. The wildlife corridor shall be provided in the eastern portion of the property to connect with existing or potential wildlife corridor linkages on neighboring properties, and that impacts to native habitat shall require on-site mitigation through restoration or creation of habitat within the corridor linkage. Staff has reviewed the proposed line between the residential use and open space and determined it is consistent with the LCP and the HMP, or Habitat Management Plan standards. Therefore, we're recommending approval as submitted. The proposed open space land use designation would apply to the southeastern 11.5 acres, and the residential designations would apply to the northwestern 5.1 acres of the site. The remaining 3.8 acres are associated with construction of Poinsettia Lane and previously permitted on-site grading, including construction of Cassia Road and some portions of Poinsettia Lane. Mitigation has been provided for these impacts, and in some cases, the area is not developable by the property owner, so these areas have not been considered part of the maximum 25% developable area as proposed. This credit for all previously graded areas should have been addressed in an HMP LCP site standards amendment, but we would typically require an LCP amendment to change this standard. But essentially, this standard change, whether the Cassia Road improvement should be exempt from the 25% developable area, is before this commission with the LCP amendment. Staff has considered this, and we feel this credit does not significantly change the project design or habitat impacts, and the proposed land use designation and zoning would accommodate development that's in conformance with the certified HMP and LCP. The LCP also requires a 20-foot buffer between development and native upland vegetation in the Carlsbad LCP. and the buffer area is allowed to include low-level fuel modification for brush management. It's fuel modification zone 3. It's staff's position that if any thinning or clearance is required to establish zone 3 fuel modification, this should be accommodated within the 25% developable area and not the designated habitat preserve, because the commission recognizes fuel modification as an impact. And this point is one that we want to specifically address in our review of the HMP implementation plan amendment, which has been submitted and will be brought forward to the commission in the near future. We will also consider this point when reviewing the notice of final action on the proposed residential development to determine if the appeal is, if an appeal is warranted. But at this point, it looks like all of the required fuel modification is accommodated within the 25% developable area. There may also be other elements of the development we feel are not wholly consistent with the HMP, such as the mitigation requirements. This is another area that we want to specifically address in the HMP implementation plan amendment and may be a potential grounds for appeal of the underlying permit. But those issues are not what's before the commission at this time. The proposed line between the land designated residential and open space would allow development on the most disturbed and least sensitive areas of the property, preserving the undisturbed habitat and open space. And therefore, again, we are recommending approval as submitted, and the motions and resolutions are on page 5 of the staff report.
Thank you very much for that presentation. We have, first I'd like to ask for ex parties, starting on my left, if there's any ex parties. No ex parties, any on my right. We have two speaker slips from before I open the public hearing, David Yaquinto and Jack Henton, and you're both here, according to this, just to answer questions if necessary. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Then that's all we have, and we can open and close the public hearing. And I'll afford staff. Is there anything else you want to add?
Nothing to add.
Okay. And with that, I'll go to Commissioner Wasel.
Yes, I move that the commission certify the land use plan amendment for the city of Carlsbad as submitted and recommend a yes vote.
Second.
Been moved by Commissioner Wasel, seconded by Commissioner Kajian. They're both the maker and the seconder asking for a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the certification of the land use plan amendment as submitted and adoption of the resolutions and findings that are contained in the staff report. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission unanimously approves or hereby certifies the land use plan amendment for the city of Carlsbad as submitted and adopts the resolutions and findings contained in the staff report. Commissioner Wasel, second motion.
Can you help me with that, please?
Yeah. Commissioner Akajian?
I move that the commission reject the implementation program amended for the city of Carlsbad as submitted and recommend a no vote.
Did you second that, Commissioner
Yes.
Wasel? Okay. Commissioner Akajian moved and Commissioner Wasel seconded. They're both the maker and seconder. They're asking for a no vote. This no vote, failure of this motion will result in the certification of the implementation program amendment as submitted and adoption of the resolutions and findings as contained in the staff report. Is there any objection to a unanimous no roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission hereby unanimously certifies the implementation amendment for the city of Carlsbad as submitted. Okay.
The next item, 6B, Alan Lyerly of the San Diego office will present this item.
There's no speakers on this next one, just so you know.
And I have a very brief presentation on it, too.
Thank you for taking my lead there.
Good morning, commissioners. The city of San Diego is proposing to amend its implementation plan to rezone an existing 10.22-acre property in the North City community of Carmel Valley within neighborhood 8B. The site is currently zoned AR11, an agricultural residential zone that is also commonly used by the city as a holding zone for areas still undergoing detailed planning. The AR11 zone requires minimum 10-acre lots with only one residence allowed per lot, although accessory structures are permitted. The proposed zones are the AR12 zone, which requires minimum 1 acre lots, and is typically used to implement very low density or state residential land use plan designations, and the OC11 zone, the most protective of the city's open space zones. The property consists of a relatively flat, previously disturbed central portion, and that already is developed with a single family home and several outbuildings. And then it slopes downward to the north and to the south, and the slopes are vegetated with southern maritime chaparral. The AR11 zone would apply only to the flat portion of the site. The OC11 zone would be the remainder of the property. The property was approved in conjunction with other approvals at the city, including a non-appealable coastal development permit for a specific project. And that project, as designed, includes all fuel modification within the 25% developable area. There is no proposed encroachment into any ESHA. The proposed zone, the AR112 zone, is consistent with the land use plan. The designation on that is split with open space over part of the property and very low residential density over the remainder. So the split zoning that's proposed for the property is fully consistent with that. The only potential issue that we identified was views. The site is on a mesa top overlooking Carmel Valley itself and could potentially be in the viewshed of several areas, public areas, including the Carmel Valley Resource Enhancement Plan area. However, the building envelopes maintain a 60-foot setback from the edge of the slope, so it's unlikely that anything that would get built on those building pads in the future could be seen from anywhere offsite the property. In summary, the amendment demonstrates that reasonable development can be accommodated on sensitive sites without impacts to ESHA. Therefore, staff recommends approval of the amendment as submitted by the city. Since the proposed rezones are consistent with the certified LUP and are adequate to carry out the intent of all applicable land use plan policies. This concludes staff's presentation, and the one motion is on page 4. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that presentation. I'll go to the commission for ex parties, starting on my left. No ex parties? Any ex parties on my right? Okay. And with that, there are no speaker slips, so I will, with that, I'll come back to the commission, to Commissioner Wesel.
I move that the commission reject implementation plan amendment number 2-0AB as submitted by the City of San Diego and recommend a no vote.
Second.
It's been moved by Commissioner Wesel and seconded by Commissioner Akajian. Both the maker and seconder are asking for a no vote. Failure of this motion will result in the certification of the implementation program amendment as submitted and adoption of the resolutions and findings contained in this staff report. Would you like to speak to your motion, Commissioner Wesel?
No, thank you.
Commissioner Akajian?
No, Mr. Chair.
Is there any other body that wants to talk about this at the commission? If not, is there any objection to unanimous no roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission unanimously votes no, which commission hereby then certifies the implementation program amendment 2-06A as submitted by the City of San Diego. Okay, and that will take us to 7C, I think.
Yes, thank you. 7C is an appeal of by the commission of a decision by the City of Oceanside. This report is only for the substantial issue question, and Tony Ross of the San Diego office would present this item.
Thank you.
May I please have the PowerPoint for this item? Okay. Good morning, commissioners. The project approved by the City of Oceanside is the demolition of three existing residential units totaling 1,430 square feet and the construction of a two-story over basement, 27-foot high, three-unit condominium building totaling 8,385 square feet. Included in the development is the vacation of 1,400 square feet of public right-of-way along the southern portion of the site. Surrounding development is Pacific Street and public access to the west, Witherby Street to the south, which is also the area where the public right-of-way would be vacated, a residential development to the north, and Tate Street and a wastewater treatment facility plant to the east. Staff is recommending the commission find substantial issue with the approved development. Also, please note the correspondence from the applicant's agent included in the addendum and also brought to the hearing by staff today. The appellant's main contention is that by allowing 1,400 square feet of public right-of-way to be used for private development, the city eliminated any future opportunity to provide additional public parking in this location. The city's LCP contains provisions for the protection of public parking and additionally includes specifically that efforts shall be made to provide additional public beach parking facilities to serve anticipated future demand with priority given for the beach area between Wisconsin and Witherby. So this development would be located in that region. Further, because this site is located directly adjacent to the terminus of Witherby, which becomes a public beach access, and because street parking is the only accommodations provided for public beach access parking in the surrounding community, any parking opportunities in this area should be maximized. The city currently maintains approximately 2,400 square foot of public right-of-way located between the project site and Witherby Street. As approved by the city, the development would include a vacation of 1,400 square feet of this right-of-way for project development. The vacation was approved with the condition that the applicant provide funding to improve parallel parking on the southern side of Witherby to 7 diagonal parking spots. However, by vacating the right-of-way and allowing private development on it, future improvements similar to this diagonal parking improvements on the southern portion of Witherby would no longer be a possibility on the northern portion of Witherby, which is the location directly adjacent to this project. Further, in granting the street application, the street vacation, the applicant was allowed a larger development envelope, resulting in impacts to public views. While the applicant states that the building development only extends into the right-of-way 4 feet, if the development was not granted the vacation, the building would be set back an additional 10 feet as required for corner lots for a total of 14 additional feet. Further, the project includes raised walls within the side yard setbacks, and it is unclear how much of these retaining walls would further impact public views. Lastly, the vacation of the public right-of-way allows for a development that may be larger and thus out of scale with the surrounding community. The city did not include a comparison of square footage with the surrounding area to address this potential impact. The applicant has since submitted, within the addendum, a floor area ratio comparison for 3 adjacent buildings. However, we do not feel that 3 buildings would be sufficient in determining the scale of the surrounding community. Further, the development in question has larger square footage, a larger floor area ratio than all the other buildings described. In conclusion, the project approved by the city includes, again, a vacation of 1,400 square feet of public right-of-way to allow the applicant to construct larger units, resulting in the potential loss of public parking for the future. These larger units also result in public view blockage and structures that could be out of scale with the surrounding development. Therefore, staff recommends that the commission find the project raises substantial issue. This concludes my comments.
Okay. And at this point, because this is just a substantial issue question, if 3 or more commissioners wish to hear the issue of the question of substantial issue, then a hearing would be held. Otherwise, substantial issue would be found.
Okay. First, I'd like to ask, is there any ex parties on this? No ex parties. Okay. I had a call, call from a Mr. Bartel on a message on procedural issue, but I don't think it was in regard to this. It was on this, I think it was on this project, but I didn't get a chance to talk to him. It's just on procedure. And an email future this would be coming up. Is there any objection? Do 3 or more commissioners object to finding substantial issue? Hearing none, the commission has found substantial issue.
Okay, the next item is item 8C, 607-179, the San Diego Bayshore Bikeway. And this item was added to the addendum to the agenda. I just want to confirm everybody has an addendum that was distributed yesterday. That's what included the staff report. And there was also a letter of opposition from the Save Our Heritage organization in that addendum. And then today, yellow addendum was passed out that has some other revisions to the staff report and response by the city, the applicant, to the opposition. And there was also Exhibit 5 included in that addendum that was not included in the staff report. This is an unusual situation in that the staff report was distributed to the commission by email last Friday on October 5th and then hand-delivered to the commission yesterday in the addendum. The interested parties did receive copies, hard copies of the staff report also on October 5th. And it was posted on the website that same day. It was also mailed to our typical press persons and the applicant on that day.
Okay. Commissioner Wan?
I have a question about the process because, frankly, I didn't receive an email. Now, it may have gone to my spam, but regardless, I didn't get the staff report until yesterday. And my concern is that, not so much with me, because I had an opportunity to read it last night, but when you release a staff report or you don't release a staff report until Friday immediately preceding a three-day weekend, and you give everyone out there, whether it's the public or the proponents of the project, basically only two working days, I don't know that. I'd like to find out how something like that could happen because that's not consistent with the practices that this commission has followed with regards to other things. Look what happened with Parkside. And I'm a little concerned about this kind of thing happening about, as I see on the, and I'm just reading from the staff report, that the file wasn't deemed complete until September 26th. It really doesn't give anybody, whether it's the public or the staff or anybody else, an opportunity to properly deal with this. So I don't know how this happened, and I'm just...
Okay. Well,
go ahead, Director Douglas. No.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to make a comment before we proceeded with our staff report and explain to you what happened here. This is unusual. While I was out, I did receive a phone call from several commissioners and Supervisor Cox from San Diego County asking whether there wasn't some way we could get this item on the agenda because of the timing, that timing constraints about construction, very narrow construction window for this project, which is a public benefit project, the bike path, and whether or not there wasn't some way we could get that done. I checked with staff. We had just received the information we had requested. We had not had an opportunity to review it. We hadn't even deemed the application complete as of 2 weeks ago. I did indicate, and I was told that there was enough time to get it on the agenda, on the addendum, so at least we would have a place marker for it. We did that on the understanding that we would then look at the information that we had to see if we could identify the issues and maybe come here with a recommendation because of the unique nature of this project. It has been in process for, 7 or 8 years. And so we said we'd try our best. I'm very concerned about the precedent of this because the staff hasn't even had an opportunity to go out on the site.
Right.
And we have issues that we're going to continue to have to deal with as this thing proceeds today because we haven't had the time. But because of the nature of the project and the fact that, we think it's a good overall project, we thought we would do our best to bring it here. This is not the way we normally bring a staff report to you. But under the circumstances, it's the best we could do. So if you could bear with us on that. Relative to the legal issue, it's my understanding that the regulations provide that that a staff report has to be out within a reasonable period of time prior to the commission acting on it. A reasonable period of time is subject to interpretation. From our perspective, we think under the circumstances, given what we're trying to do here to help move this process forward, we're doing our best. It's up to you to determine whether you think it's a reasonable period of time. And also, I am concerned about potential issues that may involve litigation. There is opposition to a portion of this project, and we don't want to create a situation that makes us legally vulnerable or creates an argument there. So we may need to go into closed session on this, actually, before we complete discussion. But that's kind of the background, and I thought we would at least go through the issues and see whether we can work something out here. It's my understanding that the construction schedule for this project, we just received it, they wish to start construction on Monday. I don't see any way that that's possible because we have recommended prior to issuance conditions in this staff recommendation, and I don't see how that can be done by Monday. The other part of the construction schedule is such that they can't finish it this year anyway. They're anticipating that they will have to continue construction next year in October and, well, at the end of next year. So that's kind of the background on it. It is unusual, but we figured we'd go through the issues, and if we can resolve the issues to our mutual satisfaction and address our concerns relative to any questions that may still be open, I'm suggesting that we may be in a position to proceed today. But that'll disclose itself as we have the discussion.
Okay. Commissioner Wiesel, you wanted to add something to that, did you?
Yes, I just wanted to concur with Director Douglas in terms of how he represented the course of events that led us to here. There was, in fact, a push to get this project here because of the timing of it. We felt that all the issues, although not to everybody's satisfaction, we thought they were fully resolved with the concurrence of Fish and Wildlife. And it took 3 years to get Fish and Wildlife to concur with the biological impacts. But in terms of the noticing issue, all the people that have had an interest in this project, in meeting with some prior to this meeting, they knew that it was going to be held in this meeting even before I did. So they've been following this project very closely. All the people that have expressed some concern about some outstanding issues are present here today. So they took the time to come here, and I appreciate that they're here to at least acknowledge that they were properly informed. The issues have not changed in terms of the point of contention. I think some of these issues are still resolvable, although even if this project was approved today. So I think the point of contention can still be resolved without a lawsuit if this project is approved today. And I just want to thank staff for bending over backwards on this and really dotting every I and crossing every T and making sure that we followed every rule to make sure this project was here. I also asked that if we ran out of time or if there was not enough information, that we would withdraw this application. So I would like to hear the information if possible, and if we determine that this project's not ready here today, then hopefully we can determine that and maybe postpone a hearing. But if the issues are the same, if they are fully resolved, maybe we can come up with a decision that makes all parties happy.
Yeah, I would like to join in what Commissioner Wiesel said and also Director Douglas, and I appreciate the staff, and it is unusual, but sometimes you want to, I believe there was the time, and a lot of people. We'd like to see the, if this project has a chance to go forward and not, and be able to start some construction, whatever, we'd give an opportunity to make that happen. And I think there was the time, and as far as I'm concerned, I think it was a fair and equitable thing to do, and no one is asking if we have not made all our legal, if it was not legally right to do it, very process or anything else, I'd be the first to tell you, let's not do it and let's postpone it. But I think at this point, that the best thing we can do is proceed with the hearing. Staff can finish their presentation, and we can see where we go. And it's like Director Douglas said, if we can resolve it today here, we will. If we're not, we'll put it off. And I don't think then anyone will have any problem with the fairness and equity of the process. Okay? So let's go back to you.
Thank you. And Diana Lilly of our San Diego staff is the person that has been primarily working on this project for the last couple of weeks. And she'll be presenting the project along with myself. We'll try to identify the issues and then hear from the city and any opposition and go from there.
Thank you. The proposed project is the construction of a 1.8-mile segment of the Bayshore Bikeway next to the South Bay Saltworks in the city of San Diego. And they're working on getting the PowerPoint presentation up now. That's not it.
There's your PowerPoint right there.
No. You know, it's the other one. I'll go ahead and continue while they work on it. Staff is recommending approval of the proposed project with special conditions requiring that the 7-foot-high fence proposed on both sides of the bike path be lowered in height and requiring that 2.7 acres of coastal sage scrub vegetation be restored to mitigate for the proposed impacts to sensitive habitat. Currently, the bike path along this segment is located on the street in the cities of Imperial Beach and San Diego. The proposed project would create a new Class 1 bicycle facility, providing a completely separate right-of-way for the exclusive use of bicyclists and pedestrians. The proposed path would connect to existing bike path segments on either side. Most of the new bike path would be located on top of a berm on an abandoned railroad right-of-way, once known as the Coronado Belt Line. This portion of the Coronado Belt Line Railway is a locally designated historical resource. The bike path would be constructed both on top of the existing railroad tracks and alongside the tracks, depending on the location of the alignment. Where the project would be located on the tracks, the existing rails would be retained in place. However, the wooden railroad ties would be removed, and then the rails would be capped with dirt and the paved bike path. A 7-foot-high chain-link security fence would be constructed on both sides of the bike path along the entire alignment to keep trespassers out of the reserve. Because a portion of the bike path would be located on the Main Street Dike, which is currently used as a haul road by the South Bay Saltworks, a new haul road would be needed. The project would relocate the existing haul road to the north of the Main Street Dike along an existing unused railroad right-of-way. The slide is adjacent to the South San Diego Bay National Wildlife Refuge, approximately 4,000 acres in South San Diego Bay of wetlands, open water, mud flats, and eelgrass beds. The project site is also located within a sub-area of the City of San Diego Multiple Species Conservation Program. The Saltworks diked ponds provide habitat for more than 94 species of migrating shorebirds, wintering waterfowl, and nesting seabirds, and comprise one of the few large feeding, nesting, and resting areas that remain along the Southern California coast. And this slide shows the existing railroad tracks and bridge where the bike path would be located. The proposed bike path would be an important part of a regionally significant public recreational trail system. However, the project would have some impacts on the surrounding habitat and sensitive species. The project would impact 856 square feet of wetlands for construction access, although these impacts would be temporary and incidental to the primary purpose of the bike path. Little or no buffer would be provided between the bike path and the wetlands, and 1.3 acres of coastal sage scrub would be permanently removed. The city has proposed to mitigate the loss of coastal sage scrub through contribution to a habitat acquisition fund. However, the commission's biologists have reviewed the project and determined that contributing to an acquisition fund to purchase habitat offsite is unacceptable. Although the biologists have determined that this coastal sage grub is not ESHA, given that the proposed impacts would occur in a wildlife refuge where there is sufficient and appropriate area for on-site mitigation to occur, purchasing habitat off-site would not be sufficient. Typically, the commission requires creation of habitat, not restoration, when existing sensitive vegetation is impacted. However, in this case, the site is surrounded by ruderal invasive vegetation that has minimal biological value but excellent restoration potential. Given the sensitive nature of the project area and the numerous sensitive species currently present on this site, restoration of a native plant community on site will have far more biological significance than purchasing habitat or trying to create habitat elsewhere and would achieve a no net loss goal. Therefore, special conditions number 6 and 7 require that the applicant mitigate and monitor for the permanent loss of 1.35 acres of coastal sage scrub by restoring existing ruderal areas to coastal sage scrub at a 2-to-1 ratio. This mitigation ratio reflects the fact that the required mitigation is restoration, not creation, and the restoration also provides mitigation for the reduced wetland buffer that the project provides and for the impact that the project is expected to have on sensitive bird species. Specifically, the proposed removal of the coastal sage grub and the fencing proposed will impact the light-footed clapper rail's ability to retreat to an appropriate wetland upland transition area that it utilizes as a refuge during high tides and flooding. Restoring the coastal sage grub on the site will help offset this impact. With regard to the fencing, commission staff is very concerned that the proposed 7-foot-high fence would have a serious impact on the scenic value of the area. As Peter mentioned, staff hasn't been on site yet, but we do think that the city hasn't done a specific analysis of how and where the fence could be sited along each segment of a path, in a manner in which that would minimize views of the fence as seen from the bike path. There may well be areas where a reduced fence height or a resiting of the fence could provide adequate security from trespassers and protect sensitive resources and not obstruct views from the bikeway. Thus, special conditions number 1 and number 2 require that this alternatives analysis be done in consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. A failure to reach an agreement on a reduced fence height and potential alternative design might require review by the executive director or the commission. As mentioned, the proposed bike trail would be partially located on an abandoned railroad track that is a locally designated historical resource. The rail tracks would be left in place, but the wooden railroad ties would be removed. San Diego Save Our Heritage Organization, SOHO, has raised objections to the removal of the railroad ties and suggested that leaving the ties in place is a feasible alternative that would avoid a significant impact to the historic character of the rail line and would avoid disturbing contaminated soils on the site. However, the city has conducted an extensive analysis of the conditions of the railroad ties and determined that the timber ties are in various states of deterioration. The deterioration presents maintenance and safety problems because if the pavement deteriorates as the ties crumble under the bike path, it can create voids and an uneven path surface. The city's response to SOHO's concerns can be found in the addendum distributed this morning. The commission's water quality staff have reviewed the city's information and agree that there are no serious contaminants on the site that would require capping the ties in place. Staff believes the city has adequately investigated alternatives and that there are no Coastal Act policies that require additional measures to protect the historic resource. And now I'd like to turn it back over to Sherilyn for a few more comments.
Thank you, Diana. Regarding the issues raised by SOHO related to the potential presence of hazardous materials, disruption of the site, and the increased construction period, these issues would be of interest to the commission due to the potential to affect coastal resources and not specifically related to the historical significance. But the city has countered that there are no hazardous materials requiring specific treatment or mitigation, and the soils will be retained on site and not exported. and that the construction window would actually be increased due to the nature of the materials and methodology required to install the geofabric and the concrete treatment necessary to keep the railroad ties in place. The city should address this issue for the commission, but it does appear that the potential alternatives have been considered by the city. The ties were preserved for installation of the segment to the west of this site, and although there were no significant problems reported to date, the retention required import of 2 feet of fill for that segment. This is a picture of the segment that is to the west of the site. And the 2 feet of fill would not be possible in this location because the segment is within the floodplain, so that would be problematic. Regarding the historical designation, the city is fully documenting the historical elements of the railroad to the point that should restoration of the railroad be an objective in the future, it seems it could be done, and it would likely require replacement of the deteriorated ties in any event. And I'd like to briefly discuss alternatives, potential alternatives. It's our understanding that the viable alternatives that were considered to avoid construction on this railroad berm would involve permanent wetland impacts. And this is one issue that this commission staff did identify for the city early on, that a new bikeway is not a permitted use in wetlands. Thus, the permanent impacts should be avoided. And the proposed design and alignment has achieved that objective. There are only temporary construction impacts required, which can be found incidental to the primary public purpose of this bikeway. The findings as currently drafted do not identify the temporary construction impacts as the permitted use in wetlands incidental to the public service of constructing the bikeway. And staff will need to bring back revised findings in any event, but that is one specific finding on page 21 that we will modify and incorporate that change in any elements of the commission action today in revised findings. The city has indicated that the conditions addressing the revised fence height and additional coastal sage scrub mitigation requirements are problematic, and they can address their concerns there. Staff feels that we don't like to be at odds with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but we do need to question the need for the full extent of the fence in all the locations. There is a post and rail fence, such as this one, on the existing alignment that is going to be provided on both sides of this proposed trail. So this will deter access down the slope. And then we also have a condition that addresses landscaping to further discourage traffic on those slopes. We feel we need to have an in-depth consultation with the representatives on site to fully analyze the options and the resource agency concerns. And we don't have that information to present today. We can address it through a condition of approval. We can discuss maybe changes to the condition after hearing from the applicant as to ways that we might be able to accommodate that consultation within the construction schedule that they're anticipating. But this is an example of what the views would be through a chain link fence. This is at the trailhead, and this is the nature of the area where the trail would go. So you can see what our concern is regarding the installation of chain link fencing. In addition, as Peter mentioned, the proposed construction schedule has just been submitted this week, and they were anticipating they would be able to start construction on Monday, which isn't realistic. They can address their construction schedule so that we can all know what the consequences of the commission's action today would be. This is the alignment of the bikeway as it crosses through the refuge. And this is an example of the railroad bridge that will be replaced, and the alignment would go along this area. I Again, I showed this picture. This is the existing segment to the west, and it shows the post and cable that would be also proposed on this alignment. I'm going backwards. But this is the existing trailhead. And to the right, the trail would go off, the proposed trail would go off to the right. The existing trail goes off to the left. And this is the nature of the existing berm and railroad trestle. That will be capped and protected in place. Did you have any other? No. And that concludes our comments at this time.
Thank you very much. With that, I'll go back to the commission for ex parties, starting on my left.
Yes, thank you. On October 26th, I believe it was a Friday, I met with Catherine Rhodes, who came to my office hours in Sunny Cedar to talk about this project, and she expressed concern over information contained in the environmental impact report that stated that, in her opinion, the information was incorrect concerning the railroad ties, that they did not have to be removed, and that the paving could be accomplished by not removing the railroad ties. I also met with city staff on several occasions following the approval of this project at City Council to talk about whether this project was fully vetted and ready to go, and whether they had responded to Coastal Commission concerns, and whether this project was ready to be heard here by the Coastal Commission. I also met with Supervisor Greg Cox. Today, this morning, prior to this meeting, he spoke about just some concerns about the fence requirement by staff, that it's inconsistent with Fish and Wildlife Service, and whether this is an issue that is appropriate in terms of wondering if that's going to create an unneeded conflict with Fish and Wildlife Service. And I met with him last week in a phone call to discuss the whether this issue was going to be heard at the Coastal Commission. That was actually 2 weeks ago on a Friday, also the 26th, speaking about whether this project was docketed.
Okay. And I had a brief one before the meeting started this morning with Supervisor Greg Cox. I ran into him. He said hello and mentioned he was down to one or two issues and loved to see the project approved today. And it's been a long time, and he was appreciative of the efforts to make that it was here today for a hearing. Anyone else? Okay. With that, then, I'll open up the public hearing and call on the city representative. And I'm sorry, sir, I can't read your last name. Is it Frank Gaines? Or okay, thank you.
Good morning, commissioners.
How much time, sir, are you requesting for your presentation?
About 5 minutes.
Okay, and do you want to save a few minutes for rebuttal, sir?
Sure.
Okay, so 5 minutes, and we'll save 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Got it. I'm Frank Gaines. I'm the project manager for the applicant, City of San Diego Engineering and Capital Projects. This is a section of the Bayshore Bikeway reflected at the bottom of that picture as the dashed green line. It's a 24-mile circuit around San Diego Bay. This is one of the missing segments. This existing segment now goes and follows that yellow line at the very bottom along Palm Avenue, which is one of the most dangerous segments in town as far as bike accidents and injuries. The proposed road, haul road, there is being relocated to the upper end We will be using the bike path along from where it says bike path to start over to the bike path to end. The existing Hall Road is used by heavy trucks, which use the salt works ponds to create salt. They truck it to the salt processing plant. We would be relocating the trucks to the Hall Road to eliminate conflicts between the bikes and trucks along that berm. This is the proposed bike path section. We have eliminated the post and cable section because of the nearness of the security fencing required by Fish and Wildlife. In some places, they're approximately a foot to 2 feet away. Wherever we can move it further down the berm, it's done so. We want to stay within the right-of-way that we have from the Metropolitan Transit System and stay out of the wetlands delineation. You'll notice that it shows 1 foot of fill over the top of the existing tracks. Our FEMA analysis for the floodplain says that that is the maximum that we can place there. This is an example of an interpretive facility that would be used at each end of the bike path, would reflect the biology as well as the historic aspects of the existing Coronado Beltline. The historic resource was designated only in the city of San Diego, the state, the federal government. Chula Vista, Coronado, National City, and Imperial Beach did not do so. That's a section showing the berm. This is the south end and Imperial Beach. You can see that the Otay River runs alongside of it for most of the extent of the project. That's an existing section, which I guess somebody else had a good slide, the same one. Shows the condition of the ties. That will be replaced with a steel bridge over the top of the existing bridge to retain it in place. That's the same bridge closer up. This is the northernmost bridge. Another steel bridge would be placed along top of that. The existing bridge would be retained in place. That's an example of the coastal sage scrub that exists now along that berm. You can see the quality is not good. It's not a gnat catcher habitat. That's the existing condition of the ties. More tie conditions. This shows the extent of the ties that would be taken out and the ties that would remain in place. Approximately 51% of the ties along the length of the project would be removed. 49% would remain in place. That's a visual representation, a good photoshopping of what the future steel bridges would look like. They vary in length, but they're approximately the same height. One is wider. That's where it connects into the Imperial Beach section. That section has got a 2 feet of fill placed upon it. Imperial Beach has experienced no real maintenance problems, but that's due to the fact that it was placed in a different environment. This rail line was built on a maritime environment, an artificial fill and alluvium berm. This is natural sedimentary soils. That's the section we were just looking at in an aerial view. You can see where the line curves. That's on native soils. Another picture of the ties and rails to remain. This is right next to an interpretive facility. And that's my end of my PowerPoint. We have no problem with the fencing requirement. We wish to work with Fish and Wildlife and coastal staff to reach an acceptable fence height. I will do whatever they can settle between the two. I just do not want the project to stop because we can't reach an agreement today. Same thing with the location of the fence. We will locate the fence as close to the bottom of the berm as we are possibly able to. Regarding the coastal sage restoration, this morning we had a discussion between staff, Andy Ewan from Fish and Wildlife Service, who's here to discuss this with you. And I think we reached a possible agreement to, in the future, develop those 2.7 acres. Fish and Wildlife is not currently done with their design for their refuge, but it would be possible to restore that on their site, and we could reach a future agreement. That's the end of my presentation. Any questions?
Thank you, sir. We'll ask you questions if we want to in a little bit. Mr. Vance, Stephen Vance. Three minutes, sir?
Yes, if that. Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Stefan Vance. I'm here on behalf of the San Diego Association of Governments, the Metropolitan Planning Organization in the San Diego region. We're the major funder for this project, and I have personally been involved in its development for well beyond the 7 years that it's been a formal project with the City of San Diego. The Bayshore Bikeway is an important part of our regional bicycle network. This project will contribute significantly to improving non-motorized transportation in the South Bay area, as well as providing better coastal access for a non-polluting form of transportation that we're trying to promote in San Diego. It also has statewide significance, by the way, in that it is also part of the California Coastal Trail. You'll hear from others speaking on this project as well, the extent to which we've been working long and hard to get to the point where we have a project that's going to serve the needs of bicyclists and pedestrians and also respects the important resources that are in this area. It's been a very difficult project. We think we've done everything possible to get to the point where we've gotten the best possible project. And with that, I would encourage you to move forward today to issue the permit so this project can go forward. I should also say that I kind of wearing two hats here because I am a member of the board of directors of the San Diego County Bicycle Coalition, and their executive director could not be here today, but I can tell you that bicyclists in the San Diego region are very eager to see this project go forward, and we're anxious to see that the permit gets issued today so that the construction can begin. With that, I'll thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Vance. Thank you for your testimony. Andrew Yoon. Three minutes, sir.
Yes. My name is Andrew Ewan. I'm the manager for the San Diego National Wildlife Refuges in San Diego County. We've been working with the City of San Diego, the San Diego Association of Governments, and the County of San Diego to address the environmental concerns that we had regarding the Bayshore Bikeway. As it has been discussed, we've spent a lot of time trying to find a solution to many of the concerns that were raised. We now support the project as proposed. We've worked long and hard to identify the fencing height, the types of fencing, and the other issues related to the Bayshore Bikeway, and appreciate the efforts by the City of San Diego to address our concerns and to eliminate our concerns about its impact on the National Wildlife Refuge. The Bayshore Bikeway goes through a jewel of the National Wildlife Refuge. The South San Diego Bay Unit is a tremendously productive area for seabirds, shorebirds, a variety of endangered shorebirds nest on the site. They're all nesting on the ground. And so our concern had been that trespass onto the refuge would impact the valuable nesting and foraging habitats that exist on the refuge. And so the height of the fence and the type of the fence, the type of fencing, and the location of that fence was a very important issue to us. And we've worked with the city to find a solution that I think meets both their needs and our concerns regarding protecting endangered species. We understand the concerns that had been raised about balancing views versus endangered species, and we think that over time working with the city and the county and SANDAG, we've met that balance to meet the needs of endangered species and for the Bayshore Bikeway. We also spoke this morning with the executive director about the opportunity to find 2.7 acres of habitat within the San Diego National Wildlife Refuge to assist the city in offsetting their loss of maritime coastal sage grub habitat. And we're more than willing to work with the Coastal Commission staff and the city to come to an agreement on that mitigation occurring on the refuge. It's immediately adjacent to the Bayshore Bikeway, and so the issue about it being on site would be addressed by having those areas on the refuge. And as Frank Gaines from the city had mentioned, we're happy to meet with the staff from the Coastal Commission, walk the right-of-way, explain our concerns, try and help them understand our concerns about protecting endangered species and the issues on the view, in helping move this permit forward and allowing the city to build the Bayshore bikeway path. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Tim Canibus, I guess you're here just answer questions? Thank you. And just for the record, Dennis Landau for answer questions also? Okay. Catherine Rhodes?
Hi, there's four of us here on the issue, so we wanted a total of 12 minutes, six for him, and then six for me.
Okay. Your name for the record, sir?
Bruce Coons, Executive Director of Save Our Heritage Organization.
And how much time for you, sir?
6 minutes, thank you.
So put it down to six, so we'll do week one.
And could we have an extra couple of minutes to rebut if we need to at
the
end?
No, you're not allowed under our procedure.
Okay,
we'd
thank
love
you.
To give it to you, but...
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission and staff, thank you for this opportunity to talk to you today about this extremely important public project. That we also support the project. We've also worked many years long and hard with the city to try to resolve the issues. We thought we had an agreement until we got the draft EIR, and that agreement was to put a geotextile material down and protect the resource and site. And we were very surprised when we got the draft EIR, something that we worked on years ago and thought we were all agreed, and we'd been supporting the project. So this is, these next few photos were taken on September 7th this year, except for this one, of course. So we move on to the next. Oh, I've got it. Thank you. This shows the rail line in Imperial Beach. You heard that there was 2 feet of fill over it. The drawings actually call for up to 18 inches, and it varies anywhere. In this case, it's probably a little less than a foot on it, and it goes down to zero in some places. When it's coming off of here, it's zero. And he also heard about the conditions, said that they were on native soils and they were in better shape. But this is an area that has cyclical wetting, and this part is subject to much more deterioration than the portion we're talking about within the wildlife refuge. And this is a very sandy, wet area. And this is on top of the bike path right now, on top of the railroad. This shows some of the early rails. You say, well, why are we so concerned about this little piece of railroad down here? But it's the only place in San Diego County where 19th century rails, this is Carnegie Rail 1899, as you see here, that is still in place. All of our other early railroads, this has been eliminated. This is also the Imperial Beach segment, and when you get up to there, there's less than 8 inches over the top of the railroad rails right there. As we move into the refuge, this is the first trestle you saw. The hole in it was made by the INS to keep illegal aliens coming across. But this is the area that is concerned with us. Between the two trestles, this is the area where the rails are in the best condition in the whole line. And this also shows some of the contaminants that you'll hear about later that are in the soil. And directly counterpoint, the Nino and Moore report said the best option was to cap this in place. And Kurt Roebling from the Fish and Wildlife Service said because of speed, they'd rather see this capped in place too because they'd be in and out of the refuge faster. This whole idea of taking the spikes out, taking the tie plates out, unbolting the rails, taking the ties out, and disposing of the material is a very time-consuming operation. The city has contended, though I didn't hear it today, that it's more expensive to do that. We don't believe that it is, and the initial quotes in the information that we've got show that it should be much cheaper to leave it in place. And as you've probably seen by the letter from Imperial Beach, they said they are experiencing no problems from ties or rails being in place, and that project's been in place for over 10 years. And we felt if there was any issue, any safety issue that would come up from that normal maintenance of the asphalt surface could take care of that. But there's been absolutely no evidence that capping this in place is infeasible, put in the record. There's no evidence of a safety problem other than an allegation. And I had to take a little bit of... from the staff, they said that you weren't required to preserve the resources. You're not required to do a lot of things under CEQA, but you are required to adopt a feasible mitigation measure that lessens the impact to the historic resource, and there is one. And so legally, you must adopt that feasible mitigation measure, which is to leave the ties in place. This is that section again. Once again, it's in very, very good shape. It's on the top of a very high berm and very good drainage on either side. This is the northern trestle. And then this is the section they showed you with the deteriorated ties. Ironically, this is the one section they said they're going to preserve for us. This is the one, the bike path will be on the berm above, which is where the railroad was further down in the picture. And this has cyclical wetting. Even the salt ponds come across this, and it's just in horrible condition. And that's where they showed you the bad ties. And they said, gee, well, this one we're going to leave, preserve 300 feet of it as we take out the very best and throw it away. And this is where the haul road goes. And really, in conclusion, this, there, this part of the railroad is only defensible under Secretary of Interior standards for preservation by capping it in place. We've gone a long ways. We want to see this project preserved. Most of our supporters, we had over 30 groups, the largest coalition for a historic resource in San Diego's history supporting this, wanted to see the whole thing preserved. But we realize this is an important public project. We want to see it go forward. So we've done everything we can, we think, to protect the resource as much as possible and allow the project to go forward as fast as possible. And we think that this idea of taking the ties out and throwing the rails back in there completely destroys the resource and is kind of a ridiculous activity. And that we should be able to adopt the alternative that saves that. But we've been talking about a compromise. You know, the city has alleged two things. They've alleged this is being more expensive to leave it in place, and that I will sum up here.
Your time, right.
And that there's a safety issue. If we could get independent evaluation, two or three independent evaluations of both the cost, because we don't feel that's been done, and...
Sir, your time is up.
Okay, and just two words to finish up, okay. And the safety issues, that we think that would be a good compromise to get that done. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Yes.
Oh, I'm not sure if I'm next.
Yes, you. Okay. Whatever order you would like to come in. State Definitely. Your name for the record, and how much time are you requesting?
Catherine Rhodes, and I'm requesting 6 minutes.
Well, okay, and so there's just two speakers then? You're between all of you? You were.
There was four of us. Between all of us, there was four of us. There
yeah,
was
and you, 12 minutes, right.
Yes.
But the other two are not. They're just ceding
correct.
Their time to you, correct?
Correct.
Correct. No problem, Ms. Rhodes. 6 minutes.
Thank you. This all comes down to one thing, keeping the ties in place, not and just capping it in place. The vetted alternative that was vetted, it says that the alternative is identical to the proposed project with the exception of removing the timber ties in place. As you can see, this here is on the elevated Otay Mesa berm, and I don't know if you guys have my report dated October 5th, Bayshore Bikeway and historically designated Coronado Railroad. But one of the things that I had a problem with is that the EIR was not located in the library. We all got the first volume of the EIR, but the two other volumes of the EIR were not located in the library. We couldn't get any of this information until after the public things were done, and it took me like 3 hours just to get that part of the report that found out that a lot of the things that they said at other public meetings were not actually accurate. So anyway, we just want to do exactly the same exact thing, but instead of taking out the steel spikes, taking out the steel plates, removing the plates, taking out the wooden ties, that we just cap it in place. But instead of you clear and grub it, and then you just cap it in place. And I'm also a registered civil engineer in the state of California. I have a master's in civil and environmental engineering and 20 years of construction experience. And I got involved in this because I saw the public testimony on TV, and when they were saying that it would be cheaper to take it all out. And I just know that from a construction thing not to be true. So as to the hazardous waste, in the report, in the EIR report that we didn't get to see until, you know, a week after, about a week ago, it says several Title 22 metals were detected in the samples collected. The soil sample tested contains DDT, DDE, DDT. 10 SOVs were detected, all PHS, likely from the preservatives in the railroad ties. Based on the analytical results of our soil sampling, the conclusions are listed below. If soils are disturbed during grading activities, workers will be likely to perform activities in accordance with SHHP and Community Health and Safety Plan due to the president's of contaminated soils. There is contaminated soils. Soil evaluated during this assessment has been found to contain concentrations of PHS pesticide. Therefore, if the soil is exported from the site, it's considered a hazardous waste by the Regional Water Quality Control Board. Also, these hazardous materials include aromatic carcinogenics. That means that when you disturb any of the soil and the things come up in the air, and people ingest them, the construction workers are going to be, you know, subject to carcinogenics, airborne carcinogenics, for absolutely no reason. There's no plans on with the city to actually do any type of hazardous waste. They don't even have it in the plans. They said it's not even a problem. And they testified to this, which is actually very false, and we're actually going to be following that further. Another thing is the hydrology. The vetted thing says, okay, you could have 12 inches. So what they said before is having an 8-inch a geogrid fabric, an 8-inch section of base, and a 4-inch section of asphalt. That's 12 inches. So what you could do is just put clear and grub this area right here, put in your 8 inches of base, put in your 4 inches of asphalt, and you will not have a hydrology problem. They actually went to the city of San Diego and said if you follow their own vetted things, that you're going to destroy the mobile home parks and flood out the mobile home parks further down. You don't need to do that because it's the same exact height that they said that we can have, which is 12 inches, which they already said is exactly what they needed to do. So, the scope of work is, additional things they're going to do is unbolt and remove the rail joiners, and which keep the ties together. You might have to use torches to unbolt the rusted steel, remove the steel plates, dig out the wooden ties, and dispose of the hazardous waste and contaminated and disturbed soil. The wooden ties are considered hazardous waste. So if they said, okay, they're going to retain the soil at site, that's one thing. But they're not going to retain the hazardous waste wooden ties. They're actually exporting them to the site. And they're doing all this work without a health and safety plan, which is, quite incredible. Also, all these extra non-value-added steps is actually going to hurt the wildlife and environmental concerns because you want to be in and out as soon as possible. Doing all this extra work for absolutely no reason, I have no clue why they want to do it. So in conclusion, the Bayshore Bike Path is a fabulous, wonderful project. We hope it passes, but that you just retain the historic railroad ties in place and just say, cap it in place. There's no reason. They said it's only a health and safety reason, but there is no health and safety reason to do it. In fact, there's a health and safety reason to cap it in place so the construction workers don't get hurt. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Rhodes.
Dr. Hartzell, and just from a medical point of view, when you say PAH, that stands for polycyclic.
Excuse me, sir. I thought you ceded your time to Ms. Rhodes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right. You got a minute left. Do you want to use that minute?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. You didn't. It wasn't clear. Okay.
I'm new at this.
Okay. State your name again for the record and go ahead. And
name is Dr. Conrad Hartzell. And prior to practicing medicine, I did my graduate work in mechanical engineering and applied math at Caltech in Berkeley. So I have background in engineering as well as medicine. But my concern in reading this report is from the term PAH, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Aromatic, you can breathe them in. They are highly carcinogenic. In 1992, the National Academy of Sciences said to the EPA, these are the highest level of toxins to be considered on our list of toxins. So that to have disturbed the soil, you cannot levitate those rods out of the ground. They're going to have a heavy machine. It's going to disturb the soil, and you've got aromatic compounds that will be going into the air. Leave it alone. Cap it. What's there is there. They used pesticides in the 60s and 70s to keep the sagebrush down. They didn't know better. but leave it alone. If you touch it, the EPA is going to be concerned about this.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor. Thank you for your testimony. Greg Cox, Supervisor Greg Cox. Three minutes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, could I request that Mr. Melgoza is here also. Could he cede his time to me if I go a little over 3 minutes, or is that not allowed?
Does he have a speaker?
I don't think he put in a request to speak for him.
No, this is not rebuttal. This is not rebuttal. Does he have a speaker slip in? You don't. Who's got his hand? Have you filled out a speaker slip? Go ahead and try the 3 minutes, and we need
to
go a little further.
Okay. Thank you very much. My name is Greg Cox. I'm the vice chairman of the San Diego County Board of Supervisors. And for the last 17 years, I've had the opportunity to serve as the chair of the working group through SANDAG for the Bayshore Bikeway. This portion of the Bayshore Bikeway is extremely important. The Bayshore Bikeway, when it's completed, will be a 24-mile bike loop around San Diego Bay. This section is about 1.8 miles. With the completion of this, we'll almost be halfway done with getting a separate Class 1 bike route around San Diego Bay. This portion has been very problematic. We have a situation where we have an opportunity to put a bike path on a 20-foot-wide right-of-way that has been owned by MTS and prior to that by the Coronado Beltline. Either side of that 25-foot easement is a national wildlife refuge. So you can see the dilemmas we're trying to deal with in meeting the needs of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and commission staff has come up with some conditions. We hope we can kind of work through those issues in a cooperative vein. Developing this portion of the bikeway would be a significant milestone in providing the users direct bike path that avoids busy streets. Reference was made on Saturn Avenue, where the bike path goes now. It is actually a 6-lane freeway. It is the most dangerous stretch of bicycle path anywhere in San Diego County, with the number of accidents and fatalities that have occurred over a number of years. And we want to come up with a safer bike path, and this will certainly do that. Once completed, the Bayshore Bike will become a very popular destination, not only for recreational users, as currently we have a lot of people, but frankly, it'll be a very viable mode shift. In other words, there's a lot of people that work at North Island, that work at NASCO, that will be able to get on the Bayshore Bikeway, and this will really be a viable alternative mode of transportation, and one that I think will be very well received by the public. The mitigation measures that have been included, I think, are all very appropriate. We've worked very closely in the final EIR to come up with something that would strike that balance. We certainly have not ignored the opposing views. We're aware of the concerns of SoHo. We've tried to address those as best as we can. Almost half of the bike path that will be going on the right-of-way will be preserved in place, 49%. The other portions, because of the need to build on a dike that, again, is 25 feet at the base, as you get up higher, you don't have that much room. We run into conflicts with representations or needs of FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Authority, because we can't go above 12 inches on what we're building upon. Some of the concerns that were expressed by SoHo, I think, are misplaced. They're based on the Nino and Moore study. There is no portion of this bike path that will involve any of the PCBs or any of the other nasty things that were talked about. Those are on the portions of the bike path that will actually be capped, so that should not be a concern. We would ask, certainly, in regards to the need to replace coastal sage and the requirement on the height of the fence, that we work in a cooperative vein between Coastal Commission staff and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We don't want to get caught between both of them. They're all doing good work, but we need to come up with a plan that works, and I would hope that maybe the staff at the Coastal Commission and Fish and Wildlife Service can get together and work out these issues without the need to bring things back to this commission. In closing, let me just say I really appreciate the cooperation we had from staff. I know that bringing this item and forward in the time frame that we've been looking at has been difficult, but at the same time, we are in a very short window. October 15th to February 15th is our only opportunity to move forward on this project. Otherwise, we have to wait until next September or October to get started again. It may actually go over two seasons. If it does, obviously, we will deal with that. The cost differential on this to do what SoHo has suggested, and that is to basically leave the ties in place, actually will be $177,000 more than removing the wooden ties. And, you know, cost is not the only consideration, but it certainly is a consideration, and we would ask for your concurrence and consideration, and thank you for the additional time.
Thank you, Supervisor Cox. And now we'll go back to Mr. Gaines for your rebuttal time. 3 minutes, sir.
The concerns that have been expressed regarding the additional cost and misrepresentations, we feel like we've addressed the issues. We took our designs in front of an independent peer review by Caltrans and Sandag engineers. They took the plans apart, took the specifications apart, and said, why did you design it this way? Why did you do this? Why is this height? Why is this low? And they agreed with all of our design considerations. I think we've met the balance that we need to show. We've put the project out for bid. I received bids for this additional work over the ties, four different bids. The low bidder had a $177,000 cost. All of the bids were within 10% of each other. That tells you that's what it cost to do that work. That's an independent financial analysis. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Gaines. And with that, I'll go back to staff.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Well, let's do the best we can here. We did look at, and we haven't had the opportunity to discuss this with the city to the extent that that we certainly would have wanted to, but I'm very concerned about the concerns raised relative to the historic preservation of the railroad ties and the rails. And we had recommended a condition that they be retained in place. And frankly, from our perspective, we don't see why that can't be done. And after discussing it with the city, we did delete that condition, but I'm inclined to reinsert that. So we're changing our staff recommendation to recommend that the rails and ties be retained in place and capped. Then it'll be up to you to deal with that. Another condition I want to add, I have discussed this with a SOHO representative. It's my understanding that they are prepared to file litigation on this matter if the alternative that is being proposed is not adopted, that we add an indemnification clause to the conditions that we're recommending. Those would be the two changes, and then obviously it'll be up to you to discuss it. The other issue that was raised relative to timing, I've discussed this with Sherilyn, and we think that there are some modifications that can be made relative to timing. We don't normally like to do that because we end up most of the time buying problems later if it's not prior to issuance, but because of the public nature and benefits of this project and an attempt to try to find a solution here, we're going to make some suggested changes here that we think address that problem. So, Sherilyn, do you want to mention those?
Yes, looking at the conditions that are drafted as prior to issuance now, number 4 for the staging areas, number 8 that address water quality measures, and number 10, the grading and erosion control measures, those appear to be appropriately prior to issuance. They are basically complied with the submittal of the plans, and they would be certainly complied with submittal of the final plans for the project and should be submitted prior to commencement of construction. Special condition number 6 regarding the coastal sage scrub restoration, and number 7, the monitoring. We would suggest that that be changed to within 90 days of commission action on the project. That should allow time to work out the mitigation sites and the components of those programs, and we recommend that that change be made for the coastal sage scrub mitigation.
Can you repeat that specific recommendation again? I'm sorry.
Condition number 6 and 7 changed the prior to issuance to within 90 days of commission action. And on condition number 9 for the landscaping, the same thing. We would like to have more time to work with the landscaping because we think there is a connection between the landscaping and the fencing that might be able to address some of the concerns regarding access into the refuge. So we would like to change condition number 9 to within 90 days of commission action. And then condition number 2 on the fencing, our suggestion is to change that to prior to installation of any fencing. We are understanding that that's one of the last components that would be installed as part of the project. So that would give us time to work with Fish and Wildlife Service and the applicant. So we'd like to change number two to prior to installation. On that one point, though, for any chain link fencing that may be approved, we would like to add a provision that requires that it be maintained. Because as the slide indicated, some of the chain link fencing, some of the real adverse visual effects of it are related to the fact that they just haven't been maintained. And then finally, in the fencing condition number two, right now it says failure to reach agreement on the reuse fence height shall require an amendment to this permit. We'd like to change that to may require an amendment, that you give the discretion to the executive director to work out a revised fence height and alignment. And at some point there, we may feel that that needs to come back to the commission, but we would like to be able to have the opportunity to work it out in the field.
That latter change is, as I recall, similar to what we did on some fencing next to a Navy project in Coronado, where we did go back and look at the height of the fence because of the concern about the visual impact of it. And you gave us the direction to try to work out some compromise there. And if we couldn't, they could go forward with it. And I think also if we felt that there really wasn't a good reason not to make the change, we could have required it to come back to the commission, but we didn't. And the Navy went ahead and constructed it the way that it was proposed. So our intent here is to kind of parallel that.
And just finally, I didn't specifically address special condition number one, but that's the revised final plans, and we feel that should continue to be a prior to issuance condition.
Okay. Okay. Okay, thank you. And with that, I'll come back to the commission. Commissioner Wiesel.
I'd like to go over the staff recommendations and ask some questions, and I'll tell you where I have my concerns. I'm concerned that in ceding to some concerns regarding the project in terms of saying we will allow for the fill, we're going to open up some other problems in terms of the potential flooding and the ponding that could create that would maybe even bring a lawsuit from someone else. So we're preventing a lawsuit and trying to prevent a lawsuit. We're opening up some other lawsuit opportunities, and I'm just concerned about that. I want to make sure we don't do that. In terms of, I also have questions for Mr. Gaines. If I don't know if somebody here from Wildlife is here, but yes, okay. I understand the staff recommendation on the fence. I think that's a good item. But in terms of the actual fill itself, I mean, cost is an issue, but not it shouldn't be the reason why we do what we do. I think we should do the most environmentally appropriate thing. And in terms of moving forward and bringing in the fill, would that create a ponding hazard or flooding hazard?
The additional pavement section over the ties is actually not higher than what we have otherwise. Reason being, we substituted the geogrid fabric and a cement-treated base for what would be soil under the base bid alternative, which is removing the ties. The height of the path would remain the same. That was to keep within the FEMA regulations. So the actual fill height would not change. The materials would change. They're more expensive.
Okay.
The reason that we are opposed to the CTB geogrid fabric alternative is because, in our engineering opinion, and I'm a registered civil engineer as well, we met with a peer review with about 14 civil engineers, and we said, look, due to the height restrictions, this thin section that you're putting over the top of what will obviously decompose, wood buried in soil decomposes.
Yep.
Because of the thin section and the possibility of voids occurring below that, you reach a situation where you're building a maintenance problem, a liability problem if there's any differential settlements of that thin section. We did the best we could to come up with what was a good design alternative engineering-wise based on the limitation of that thin section, I don't know how long it lasts. I don't know what the maintenance cost will be. I don't know what the liability potential is. If there should be any differential settlement, I prefer not to do it.
Okay.
You got a very good point.
That's interesting. And Ms. Sarb, can I go over the recommendations again? I want to specifically point to the extensions in time you went from on page 8 of the report, provision E, I think, provision for submittal. You increased within 30 days of completion of initial planning work to 90 days. Did I catch the right one?
No, just instead of prior to issuance of the permit.
Number seven, permit. Okay.
That the information be submitted within 90 days of commission action.
Is that acceptable to the applicant?
Was that the CSS restoration?
Yes, the mitigation program and monitoring program.
In discussions with Andy today, I think that we could reach an agreement. I don't know if there would be an executed agreement, but it would be a three-party agreement: coastal staff, city, and Fish and Wildlife. Here's where our plan is, here's where we're going, here's the goals, and how it gets achieved in the timeline would have to be worked on. And I find that acceptable within 90 days, if that's what you're asking.
Yes, that is what would be consistent with the condition, to develop the program, not to actually implement the program.
Okay, I can do that.
Okay, great.
Commissioner Wiesel, any other questions?
That's all.
For right now, and we'll come back.
That's all for right now.
Commissioner Wan.
I have a couple of questions and concerns. Most of them are kind of minor. The little concern here that we've decided this isn't Esha without staff going looking on it, and you should never have put up that slide showing that this was not Esha, because I got news for you that coastal sage scrub is coastal sage scrub. That's what it looks like. Looks like weeds to most people, but when you know what coastal sage scrub is, that's what it is. But setting that aside, I have one minor change in the landscaping condition. Since we are dealing here with landscaping that's either in or immediately adjacent to a national wildlife refuge, that on 9A, where it says the landscape palette should include the use of drought-tolerant native and non-invasive species, I think these need to be native species of local stock. This is an important habitat area, and that should be even if they're not invasive, you shouldn't be planting non-native species. The other thing
that's
that
not a problem when
okay.
we incorporate
the,
that.
That's minor. The other thing that concerns me, and I have to say this, is that I'm concerned when the findings talk in terms of that this is a permissible use of fill of wetlands, that it's an incidental public service. I think you're going down a dangerous path there. I think it would be much better to say that this is a permissible fill of wetlands based on that it's at least in part nature study. They have a kiosk, they have signs up that say nature study and talk about the reserve. My concern is that when you talk about incidental public purpose, public use, it means incidental to what? This is a new road, basically, a new section of road. And so I don't know what's incidental here. And my suggestion is, just in an exercise of precaution, particularly if there might be litigation, that you change it to that this is based on nature study. I'm just trying to protect us.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'll ask Ms. Roach to respond to that. But that was a concern to us, too. And either one of these legs for this stool to stand on constitute a slippery slope. So what we're trying to do is narrow it as best we can, and it's my understanding from Ms. Roach that the incidental public service is that the temporary fill impacts here are incidental to the bike path itself. It's not the bike path because there are no permanent impacts. So it's the temporary impacts which are incidental to the main facility. I think that's right, but Amy may be able to explain that better. You want to do that, please?
Yes, I would like to add the wetland impacts are resulting from placing planks on top of the wetland plants in order to access the berm where the railroad is, and so that the bike path can be placed in the location of the railroad. So the wetlands are not being filled for the purpose of having a bike path on top of them, which would mean that if that were happening, then the primary purpose of the fill would be so that you could pave those wetlands and ride a bike on them. And that would not then be an incidental to building the bike path. That would be the primary purpose. Here, the primary purpose is the bike path, which is not going on top of wetlands. So the adverse impacts to wetland is simply resulting from gaining access to the area to build the bike path. Once the path is built, the planks will be removed and the wetland would be restored there. So that's why I think you can conclude that the temporary construction impacts are incidental to the main purpose of the bike path. So that would be different from a new road that is going on top of wetlands, where there you would have the primary purpose is filling the wetlands for a road, and that would not be incidental to constructing the road.
I see what you're trying to say. You can see what my concerns are, because as Peter said, in both instances, it's kind of a question of what's the best path. And as the attorneys, I guess you'll have to make that decision. But I think we should give you the ability to look at that again in depth and make a decision as to what the basis for that is.
I think what we're bringing to you is a recommendation that's as narrowly crafted as possible. And I think with the discussion that we've just had, that we've done that. I think it's the temporary nature, really, that's the primary basis. So with that combination of the nature study, the temporary impacts, that the impacts on wetlands are incidental to, secondary to, not necessary for the bike path itself, I think we've narrowed the interpretation such that we're not in danger of falling down that slippery slope.
Any other questions from commissioners? No?
Okay. Commissioner Wiesel?
Yes, I move that the commission approve coastal development permit number 6-07-79 pursuant to the staff recommendation. Recommend a yes vote.
Second. We did.
Moved by Commissioner Wiesel and seconded by Commissioner Akajian.
Question. For the chair? Yes, question. Did the maker of the motion include the staff recommendation relative to indemnification?
Yes.
Everything so far.
Yes.
Yes.
So far,
and, everything. And Commissioner Kinsey, that was part of the staff recommendation.
Thank
so
you.
Yeah.
If you want to make any changes, this would be the time to do
no.
that.
No, I like that. Yeah.
Thank you
sure.
for asking the questions so it's clear to everybody. Thank you, Commissioner Kinsey. But everything's included at this point. So they've asked, the maker and second have asked for a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the approval of the permit as conditioned and with the additions per staff today on the recommendation and adoption of the resolutions and findings contained in the staff report. Would you speak, Commissioner Wiesel, to your motion?
Prior to speaking, I'd like to make an amending motion.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
I'd also like to make an amending motion to remove the provision regarding the staff's recommendation to leave the railroad ties in place.
Capping the railroad ties?
Capping the railroad ties, yes.
Okay. Is everyone clear on that? Do you have a second to that?
Second.
Commissioner Akajian. So it's moved by Commissioner Wiesel, seconded by Commissioner Akajian, and their amending motion is to remove the staff recommendation on capping the railroad ties. So would you like to speak to that motion, Commissioner Wiesel?
Yes, I would. And first of all, I want to thank Bruce Coons and Catherine Rhodes for making the trip down here to speak on this issue. Everything they said was correct in terms of expecting that the railroad ties be kept in place. You know, everything they've done in terms of trying to preserve the railroad ties has been just a great service to their community, and I just want to commend them for leading that charge on what is a very important historic resource. The issue that I'm running up against is the same one in terms of creating a long-term hazard, and I know hazards are not a primary concern of the Coastal Commission, but we are creating a drainage problem, a ponding problem. We have a project in my district. This is kind of a separate issue, but it's similar in that when the trolley line was built from downtown San Diego to San Ysidro, the trolley line was built on an elevated platform, and it created flooding problems for the neighborhood. And the flooding that ensued caused some homes to be flooded out, and our city had to come in and purchase those homes. And we have a lot of vacant, undevelopable land as a result of the bringing in of the rail line. And that is a very legitimate concern that creates a flooding hazard that creates some damage to ensuing residential and to some of the environmental resources as well. And that's the primary concern I have. I would love nothing more than to be able to satisfy the opposition and say we're just going to find an alternative form to make sure that this project could happen and we could preserve the railway. From my perspective, it's not a financial decision. It's not something that I'm doing to save money, but it's from the standpoint of the project costs, because I think the money can be allocated for that function if it really satisfied the concern. We saw how the Border Patrol pretty much removed a large segment of the bridge. That was one of the most significant portions of this railway, the bridge itself. They removed it in the interest of national security. And while I disagree with them doing that, and I'm sad that they did it, you know, I think that there are some interests that exceed others. And in this instance, I think this is the right course of action. Will the opposition sue? I think it's most likely. I hope they don't. I think there's still an opportunity for us to work together on this and other issues to make sure that this resource is preserved to the extent practicable. But I just think that this is something that will create rise to other problems that will also impose a legal hazard or present some legal implications not only to the Coastal Commission but to the city that would be created as our efforts to mitigate this point of contention. So I want to thank staff for getting their arms around this issue in such a short amount of time. I mean, everyone in particular, Sherilyn, Peter, everybody that just worked so hard to get this project to understand the impacts of this project. I mean, in listening to some of your commentaries and some of the recommendations you've made, you've really come to really understand this project. I just want to commend you for doing that in such a short amount of time. So,
thank you.
Again, I recommend a yes vote.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Wiesel. And I would like to, Commissioner Kajian, would you like to speak for the second on his amendment? Or if not, I have a few words to say.
Commissioner Wiesel, use my time too.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Kajian. I'd just like to add a little bit. I will support the amending motion. I think the speaker from the city of San Diego, I think his name is Mr. Gaines, hit the nail on the head. In the peer reviews, it's never wise to take something like railroad ties that are deteriorating and rotten and the condition that they're in that I've seen out there and put a cap over it. To do that is it's not a question of money either way, but the issue is they will rot, the material will thin and you will deteriorate and you will create other issues of long-term maintenance problems, liability issues, and everything else. The last thing you want to do is cap anything over that's rotten and deteriorated like this is. That's the issue to me. It's just unwise. So with that, is there anyone else on the commission? Okay, I'll any need for a roll call vote on the amending motion? If not, is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, it's unanimously approved, the amending motion. Okay, now we'll get back to the main motion that is on the floor. There's a maker and seconder asking for a yes vote. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission unanimously approves the coastal development permit for the proposed development and adopts the findings and resolutions in the staff report. And we're going to have a 10-minute bio break at this time. Thank you. Staff counsel here yet? Can we go ahead and start, or should we wait a second? Ms. Hagee. We should.
Chair Kruer, we can go ahead. Staff yes, counsel doesn't sit in on this matter.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, let's go ahead then.
We'd like to present item 10. And before I start the presentation, I'd like to note that item 11 was withdrawn. I have several things I'd like to point out. We did not receive an objection to the recordation of a notice of violation of the Coastal Act in this matter. So pursuant to Coastal Act Section 30812, the executive director recorded the notice of violation. And the hearing is unnecessary. Accordingly, only one motion needs to be made in this matter, and that motion is on page 5. Secondly, and more importantly, at the very last minute, Mr. Figas has agreed to the proposed consent order offered him by the enforcement staff prior to the September hearing. We feel that this agreement is a good one for the commission, and if approved, would both address the violations at the site and avoid any litigation for all parties. We have passed out copies of the...
Excuse me, Ms. Hagee. You're not getting into your presentation right now. Or
no,
you're just
no.
making
procedural
changes
comments.
And now, because, okay.
I wanted to just highlight that I passed out copies to all the commissioners of the revised consent order, and it looks like this. It's a copy of a fax.
Okay.
And if it's approved, it will become the official version and placed in the record, and we'll amend the motion accordingly.
Okay, and this time I will announce CCC-07-CD-08, the report today for the issuance of a cease and desist order. And I'd like to ask at this time all the alleged violators or representatives to identify themselves for the record if they're here today. If you would, this would be your time to come up and identify yourself for the
yes.
Item 10. And what's your name, sir?
My name is Ken Bareilles.
Okay.
And I'm the attorney for Mr. Figas.
Okay. And
is Robert Figas.
And he's here also?
He's here. Bob,
okay.
Put your hand up.
Okay. Thank you, sir. And then we'll call you back up and give you a chance. I'd like to also indicate that what matters are already part of the record. The staff report and discussions today during the hearing are all part of the record. And I'd like to, at this time, talk about the rules of the proceedings as far as the amount of time limits. Staff, how much time are you asking for?
A maximum of a 15, please.
Thank you, 15 minutes, okay. And the representatives or the alleged violators, how much time are you requesting, sir?
Same 15.
Yes, sir, 15 minutes it will be. And I also would like to announce that it's the right of any speaker to propose questions to the commissioners to ask. Questions can be in writing or proposed orally. Commissioners can exercise discretion to ask questions. Questions are of any speaker, not the speaker who proposed the questions. And questions must be proposed before the hearing is closed. So that will be our procedure. At this time, I will open the public hearing with the staff presentation.
Thank you, Chair Kerr. We're very pleased about this development and really appreciate Mr. Figas's cooperation as well as that of the City of Eureka, who is here today to answer any questions. We've worked closely with them in both bringing this matter in and resolving it. We are recommending that you issue a consent cease and desist order to Robert and Catherine Figas, hereinafter referred to as respondents, with respect to violations on their property located at 4900 Broadway Avenue in the City of Eureka. The record consists of the contents of the staff report, its attachments, the commission cease and desist order file for this matter, today's presentation, the addendum, and the revised staff recommendation for the consent cease and desist order. Next slide. Slide 2 is a map showing the approximate location of the respondent's property in southwest Eureka near the Elk River estuary, where the river drains into the Humboldt Bay. Next slide. Slide 3 is an aerial photograph of the site showing the property where once was located an animal shelter facility. It is still referred to by locals as the old dog pound site. The property is a 2,700 square foot parcel that is located approximately 630 feet east of the Elk River, which you can see on the left. The respondents own another parcel immediately south of the dog pound site. Oh, it didn't. Referred to as the Tallow Works site because it was once the site of a rendering plant. The City of Eureka has determined that the Tallow Works site constitutes a public nuisance, as in currently in court with them over this matter. The city asks that the commission assume primary enforcement authority over the dog pound site only, not the Tallow Works site, and thus any reference to the property in today's presentation is referencing chiefly the dog pound site. This property is surrounded by the Elk River Wildlife Area, approximately 300 acres of coastal marshes, riparian wetlands, and the Elk River and its many tributaries. It is home to species that protect the Elk River estuary, Humboldt Bay, largest estuary. Although numerous wetland areas are found in the wildlife area, you can see submerged areas here. The wildlife area is co-managed by the City of Eureka and the California Department of Fish and Game and is home to waterfowl, river otters, gray fox, and threatened species such as coho and Chinook salmon, and cutthroat and steelhead trout. Except for the property and the Tallow Works site, all of the land in this photo is part of the Elk River Wildlife Area. Next slide. The matter before you today pertains to unpermitted development activities on the site, including site clearance and the placement of concrete block walls. Although the walls are located in the general vicinity of a building that respondents demolished, the construction of the walls was undertaken without a CDP. Both photos on this slide show the unpermitted concrete walls, and the photo on the right, you can also see some piles of debris that have been placed on the site without a permit. The rock piles that are placed on the site are approximately 7 feet tall. Next slide. You can see the rock piles in this photo. In addition to the concrete walls, debris and rock building materials, including 20 large truckloads of rock, were placed on the property, also within wetland buffer. I will discuss the resource impacts associated with all of the cited unpermitted development shortly. Slide 6. In February of 2006, city officials conducted an inspection of the property and observed the unpermitted concrete block walls, which appeared to have been recently constructed, and unpermitted other matters. The city observed additional unpermitted development in April of 2006 and in June 2007. Next slide. Since the discovery of unpermitted development on the property in February of 2006, the city has notified respondents of the presence of coastal act violations on the property and sought resolution of the violations. In light of the fact that we're settling this matter, I'm going to skip the text for most of this discussion. The respondents submitted a CDP application to the city in May of 2006, and the city sent a letter shortly thereafter enumerating the items which were missing but necessary to complete the application. The application was incomplete for some time, and the city returned it to the respondents in August of 2007. During that time, the city observed more unpermitted development consisting of the 20 large truckloads of rocks. Sydney Olson from the city's Eureka Community Development Division is here to answer any questions you might have regarding the city's efforts or their views regarding their site or this proposed settlement. Next slide.
Let me ask you a question on that, because this would be the time to clarify that I did find a third speaker slip from Ms. Sydney Olson, mm-hmm. and she's here to answer questions.
She is.
Yeah, not to speak, but to answer questions. Or could I clarify that, because I know from the city of Eureka. Is she asking to be?
I believe she would like to speak to the matter, which is appropriate. It's we okay. have public comment on.
So she's been in the loop. The city of Eureka has, etc. Okay, then we'll grant her 3 minutes of time. You know, I want to set the time on everyone.
Okay.
And she would come after the alleged violators.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Slide 8. In July of 2007, the city formally requested that the commission assume primary enforcement authority with respect to the coastal violations on the property. The respondents were then notified that the commission had assumed enforcement authority in this matter and that they were to contact the commission. The city rescinded the second administrative citation at that time based solely on the commission assuming primary enforcement authority. I won't, again, go into great detail, but on July 24th, the executive director issued respondents a notice of intent to record a notice of violation against the property and to commence these proceedings. Staff had hoped originally, as I think the commission is aware, to hold this hearing and locally in September in Eureka, which would have been more convenient for the city and respondents and concerned members of the public, some of which who had indicated an interest in attending. But we didn't work it out to have an agreement to have it heard in September, and because of some potential concerns and wanting to be conservative on the issue of notice, we put it over and postponed it until this hearing today. We've made, as I stated, prior discussions were unsuccessful, but earlier this morning we were able to reach an agreement on a proposed consent order. Next slide. We'll skip this slide, slide 10. The commission has the authority to issue the proposed consent cease and desist order under Coastal Act Section 30810. Although the property lies with the Eureka's within the City of Eureka certified LCP jurisdiction, the city formally requested that the commission assume primary enforcement authority in this matter, and the activities at issue satisfy the criteria for issuance of the proposed consent order under 30810. Next slide. Although a finding that unpermitted development is inconsistent with the policies of Chapter 3 is not required for the issuance of a consent cease and desist order, information regarding Chapter 3 resource impacts provides additional information regarding the importance of the proposed actions. So I'll just briefly note some of the concerns. The property is surrounded, as I said, by the Elk River Wildlife Area. It is within the Elk River watershed and is immediately adjacent to environmentally sensitive wetland and riparian habitat, as well as the Elk River and tributaries. The concern was that polluted runoff from the unpermitted development could impact adjacent ESHA and or affect the biological productivity of the watershed. In addition, there were concerns that some of the materials from the disposed matter might leak into the water and cause water quality impacts. It is also believed that there are wetlands on the property and that at a minimum, the property is immediately adjacent to identified wetlands. The city had required that the respondents submit a wetland delineation and biological inventory as part of their CDP application. We understand from Mr. Figas that he will be performing the necessary studies to complete any CDP he wishes to get for development on the site in the future. And any proposed development on the site in the future would require analysis to prevent impacts to adjacent and on-site ESHAs. Next slide. The terms of the proposed consent order have been amended to reflect the fact of the consent nature of these proceedings. Generally, the consent order will not only direct the respondents to remove all unpermitted development on the property, but also settles the monetary claims associated with the violations and will also prohibit unpermitted activities in the future. I am going to run briefly through the major changes, and again, I passed out to all commissioners as well as the interested parties copies of the amended consent cease and desist order, and I will just briefly flip through them rather than reading them all on the mic into the record. This will become part of the formal record, but I was advised to highlight the major changes. There are some few changes in the removal plan and the compliance requirements. The consent order gives them slightly longer to comply with those things, which is located on page 3 at 2.2 and 2.3 of the order. The consent order also on page 4 has several provisions that were not in the unilateral order. 8.0 provides that the respondent agrees not to contest the jurisdiction of the commission, and 9.0 says that they agree not to contest the issuance of the order or this hearing. Page 5 Section 12.0 is the heart of the financial settlement, and provides that all of the monetary claims that the commission has with regard to these prior violations are being settled for a settlement amount of $7,000 in penalties. This replaces the list of penalties which could be obtained for these violations under litigation, which was in the original order sent with the staff report. It still requires, I would like to note, that they comply with the terms of the order and that the commission can take action to enforce the terms of the order if they don't comply with them, and it does not excuse them from any penalties or other enforcement action associated with any future violations. And in fact, they agreed to pay stipulated penalties if there is a problem in the in the implementation of this order. On page 6 of the consent order, section 16.0 also addresses the same issue of the settlement of the claims. And we added section 21.0 on page 7, which is representative authority, because the signatory for this order was Mr. Figas, and he is signing on behalf of himself and his wife and the trust. Slide number 11. In conclusion, staff strongly recommends that the commission issue the proposed consent cease and desist order to address the unpermitted development activities. We are pleased to have been able to bring a consent order to you today, and we appreciate the cooperation of Mr. Figas and the active participation and assistance of the City of Eureka in reaching this agreement. That concludes staff presentation, and I'm available to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Now it's time for the alleged violator, his representative. You want to go first, Mr. Bareilles. You have a total of 15 minutes between you and Mr. Figas.
Thank you, members of the commission. First of all, unfortunately, I got
Could
into
you
this.
Could you state your name for the record?
I'm sorry. My name is Ken Bareilles, B-A-R-E-I-L-L-E-S. I'm an attorney. My office is 533 E Street, Eureka, 95501.
Mr. Bareilles, of the 15 minutes, how much time would you like?
Half.
Okay.
6 or 7, 8 minutes.
7 minutes?
That's okay.
Fine. Thank you.
Yeah, I started to say I'm semi-retired from the practice of law. I have other business interests, and a lot of times I'm not in my office. About a month or so ago, I received a notice of certified mail, except I didn't have it. I wasn't there. It came to my office and went back to the post office. And right immediately before the hearing that they had last month up in the Eureka area, Christine Chestnut, one of the enforcement officers from, I believe, the San Francisco office, 415 area, called my office and asked me if I'd received that, which I hadn't. It was a Friday afternoon, about 5 o'clock. I went down to the post office, picked it up, and then I called her the next Monday morning. It was too late to participate in the hearing that they had in Eureka. That's why Mr. Figas and I had to come down here, which is obviously an inconvenience and expense for us. The offer, she talked to me very frankly, and she was very easy to deal with, but very firm about trying to settle this thing. And actually, looking back on it, we should have accepted her settlement. We would have saved the trip down. What she offered was $10,000 as a fine, and remove the walls and remove the drain rock. And I have never had a Coastal Commission matter before, except for a first name, Robert Niles. I settled that without going to a hearing. I dealt with a lady named Sheila Ryan, and we were able to resolve that. Took a long time to get the permits, but once we got the permits, we took care of everything within 30 days. And the reason why I told Ms. Chestnut from the San Francisco office that I didn't want to accept that offer, Mr. Figas actually wanted to accept it, but I told him, no, I didn't understand, and I didn't see the need to have to pay the fine and tear the wall down and then reapply and build the wall back up again. I said, there's got to be something. I'd never dealt with the Coastal Commission, but I said, there's got to be a way that we can admit that you built the wall without a permit and admit our liability there. We're obviously guilty of that. But I didn't really feel until I spoke with this lady this morning about the necessity of, you know, she made it clear that this type of unpermitted development just could not be tolerated, even though there was a lot of good faith aspects of what Mr. Figas did. So the bottom line was she graciously informed us, took a lot of time with Mr. Figas and myself, because this is, again, my first experience here. And the compromise, the $7,000 maybe pays our expenses, it's a few bucks we saved to come down here. But the thing is that Mr. Figas, this was an eyesore. Only one commissioner, Ms. Neely, is from that area, and this was a terrible eyesore. There was a former slaughterhouse and a tallow works. The place stunk. You could smell it almost a mile away. The former owner tried to sell it for many years, an elderly gentleman, tried to clean it up himself. He couldn't do it. He didn't have the money to pay the disposal fees. He got bids from other people to clean it up. Mr. Figas' bid was $100,000. It was the lowest bid, and he ended up, the man didn't have the money to pay for the cleanup. Mr. Figas ended up buying the property and deducting that amount from the purchase price. The property's been cleaned up. What he did wrong was he obtained a building permit from the city of Eureka, which has local jurisdiction, after the windstorm that we had up there in December 31st of 05. He didn't know at that time in this particular building that the walls had been damaged. He only asked for electrical and to put a new roof on it, blew the roof off the building. He was working for Humboldt County, clearing a slide in the Hoopa Orleans area, which is several hours from this location, when his crew contacted him and his project manager said that they found cracks in the walls, a lot of damage. He said, just take care of it. What they did, and they shouldn't have done, they took the old walls down and they rebuilt them with the brickwork, which has all been accurately portrayed in the photos. But there were no permits. They should have gone back to the city and amended their permit and put the walls in. At that time, there was no involvement with a coastal development permit. It hadn't been brought up that they, my understanding, that they had to get, in addition, a coastal development permit. They were strictly dealing with the city. The inspector was coming out from the city of Eureka. When he found out that the walls were being up, he notified Rod Hartman of the violations, and he told them they had to have the walls engineered. They got the walls engineered. The engineering plans were approved, submitted to the city, but by that time the matter had been referred for enforcement to the state. And my understanding is the city couldn't act on it until the state now exercised their jurisdiction, which they're doing today. So that's why I didn't want Mr. Figas to settle this matter and have to tear these walls back down, which was going to cost him about $7,000, and pay a fine on top of it. Now, we've seen the light on this thing. We recognize the error of our thought process, or my thought process, and Mr. Figas agreed this morning that he would pay the fine, and they've given us some time to pay it and go ahead and tear the walls down. And then he will have to reapply again and rebuild the walls in exactly the same fashion that they are now. The other issue, the dumping of the drain rock, it was alleged that he improperly dumped fill material on the property. And I paid $15 to Robert Merrill's office in Eureka. I got a copy of the coastal development plan. I'd never seen it before. And I read the definition of fill material. It's material placed in a submerged area. This area, and we submitted a packet to all of you persons this morning, and the engineer that prepared the packet, that prepared that part of it, it clearly, and the photos show a year before and then later, this is washed clean drain rock that Mr. Figas hauled in as a backhaul from his trucks to store there to use in a job nearby, rather than have to haul it several miles from the Blue Lake Arcata area to his job. He wanted to store it on his property. That time he did not know that he was unable to even store clean drain rock there. Clean drain rock, you buy it and it's very expensive. You don't use it for fill material. So the bottom line was, it's not going to be hard for us to remove the drain rock. He can do that in a couple days. To remove the wall, that can be done in a few days. We didn't want to have to do this unless we had no other choice. So this is a choice that we've agreed to. We will now participate. Once we get the authority from your commission, we will remove the walls, remove the drain rock, and then pay the fine. So I appreciate you listening to us today. I really do.
Well, thank you and for your testimony on this, Mr. Bareilles. Mr. Figas, would you like to speak? Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. And this is the time, then, we would call on the other speaker that's here, Sydney Olson, for 3 minutes.
Thank you. I'm Sydney Olson. I'm principal planner with the City of Eureka, and I very much appreciate all of the work that your staff has done. I'm also pleased that we have the consent order. I have to say that the timeline that Mr. Bareilles just gave to you is a little different than the timeline that I'm aware of, but I don't want to berate or go backwards over the past. The City of Eureka does want to move forward with this. We want to be working with Mr. Figas towards resolution to this as well as other situations that we have on the property. The city did ask and received your help in doing enforcement on this. We had become extremely frustrated. We had expended as much resources as we possibly could. We'd expended enormous amounts of staff time and resources and basically exhausted our budget in doing so. I don't want to take up a great deal of time. I think that the consent order, I think that the work that Ms. Hagee has done, I know that Ms. Neely is aware of the situation, and I would be able to answer any questions that you have. I just do want to, again, thank you so much for your help and your support in this. The city would not have been able to get this far this quickly without your help. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Thank you for coming today. And with that, I'll return to Ms. Hagee for any comments that she'd like to make.
I just have a couple of things, and I won't belabor the point since we are so pleased that we're able to settle this, but we had asked Mr. Figas and his counsel to agree to the hearing in September, and we very much wanted to have this heard last month when it was local and interested parties could attend. And so our version of those facts and those dates are slightly different than Mr. Bareilles. And in addition, I don't want to discuss at great length the settlement discussions that we had, but I would just note that one of the concerns that we had was not leaving the violation in place for any longer. And I would just note, although it's in your staff report, that they had applied for a CDP with the city for this, and that application remained incomplete for 15 months. So although we're always concerned about that, at this site in particular, we were concerned about the ability to address this quickly. And I just wanted to raise two other quick legal issues. Mr. Bareilles raised the issue of whether or not it's fill, the material placed on the site. And I would just note that the definition under the Coastal Act of unpermitted development includes development that's placement of solid materials, whether on land or in water. So it's not a traditional wetlands fill type of analysis. It's whether or not material was placed that was solid on the land. In addition, we believe that it may be in the wetlands buffer, which was one of the reasons we were concerned about it, but it's not a legal prerequisite to being able to take action under the Coastal Act. And then lastly, Mr. Bareilles said, and I don't think he intended, but I just wanted to clarify that he doesn't need further permission to remove the materials. Our consent orders function to allow people to take action after a public hearing before the commission. And in fact, the section 1.0 of the consent order says specifically that the Coastal Commission hereby authorizes and orders Catherine and Robert Figas to take action. So I don't think he meant to say that, but I just wanted to clarify so that everyone understands that he does not have to get a CDP to do the work that's required under this order. That concludes staff comments.
Thank you. I'll close the public hearing then, and I'll come back to the commission for deliberations and go to Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the commission issue the cease and desist order CCC-07-CD-08 as amended by the staff and recommend a yes vote.
Second.
It's been moved by Vice Chair Neely and seconded by Commissioner Akajian, and they're both asking for a yes vote. Would you speak to your motion, Commissioner?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to also say thank you to the parties for bringing this to a successful conclusion, I guess, but also to state to the to Mr. Bareilles and to Mr. Figas that this was a very serious matter, and that, you know, before you buy property in the coastal zone, you need to learn, do the due diligence, learn what the restrictions are, and they're not the same rules as local government. And so I'm glad that you do have a copy of the coastal plan. I'm glad that you've read it. Glad that you now know what the expectations are. And hopefully, I think this is a pretty good resolution considering how serious it is. And we hope that we don't see you back under similar circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Neely. Commissioner Akajian, anything more to add? No? Again, the maker and seconder. I'm sorry, Commissioner Wan, I didn't see you. Commissioner Wan?
Yes, I just want to reiterate what Commissioner Neely said. I think these kinds of violations are of great concern, particularly when they're in the area like this, and that we hope this is a final resolution of, if there are of this one, but also if there are any additional ones, that they be resolved as quickly as possible.
Thank you, Commissioner Wan. Anyone else? Okay. Again, the maker and seconder are asking for a yes vote. passage of this motion will result in the issuance of a consent and cease and desist order CC-07-CD-08. Is there any objection to unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission unanimously approves, hereby issues a consent cease and desist order number CCC-07-CD-08 as set forth and adopts the findings as set forth in below on the grounds that development has occurred without a coastal development permit in violation of the Coastal Act. Okay. Thank you. And now we'll go to the joint. We're going to have a joint hearing on the next one on 12 and 13. Ms. Hagee?
Yes, Chairman Kruger. Lest you think we're having a love fest in the enforcement, Butler Gibson, items 12 and 13 are also consent orders. And I'll quickly do a staff presentation.
Okay. First, I should, for the record, let's see here. Okay. First of all, I just want to announce again the item CCC-07-CD-07 and CCC-07-RO-05 and items 12 and 13. And I would ask at this time the alleged violators or representatives to identify themselves for the record. Are they here? No one here? Let the record show. Okay. I'd also like to indicate what matters are part of the record as for the staff report or any of the things in the proceeding today. Also, I'd like to announce the rules of the proceeding. First of all, I'd like to ask how much time staff is going to ask for their presentation.
12 minutes.
12 minutes, granted. And the alleged violators or representatives are not here, or I would grant them the same time or what they would request. I'd like to announce that's the right of any speaker to propose questions for the commissioners to ask questions. Questions can be in writing or proposed orally. Commissioners can exercise the discretion to ask questions, and questions are of any other speaker, not the speaker who proposes the questions, and questions must be proposed before the hearing is closed. So at this time, I'll open the public hearing with the staff presentation and go to Ms. Hagee.
Thank you, Chairman Kerr. Members of the Commission, staff would now like to present agenda items 12 and 13. We're pleased to announce that the respondents, Kenneth Butler and Judith Gibson, are willing to resolve the violations in this matter through consent, cease and desist, and restoration orders. We appreciate their responsiveness to this matter and their cooperation in reaching the proposed resolution. We are recommending that you issue a consent, cease and desist order and consent restoration order addressing unpermitted development at the property owned by respondents located on Lot 22 in Block 41 in the Pacific Shores subdivision near Crescent City in Del Norte County. I'd like to note that the record consists of the contents of the staff report and its attachments, today's presentation, the Commission's cease and desist restoration file for this matter, and the addendum. Next slide. This slide is an area location map. The property is located north of Crescent City and northwest of Lake Earl in the Pre-Coastal Act Pacific Shores subdivision. The subdivision is entirely surrounded by the 5,600-acre state-owned Lake Earl Wildlife Area and by Tolowa Dunes State Park. Next slide. This is an aerial looking north. The Pacific Shores subdivision is located just to the north of Lakes Earl and Tolowa. The area's sensitive habitat and recreational lands are protected through the Coastal Act, the Department of Fish and Game's Lake Earl Wildlife designation, as part of the Department of Parks and Recreation's Tolowa Dunes State Park, and it is also listed as one of Fish and Game's 19 coastal wetlands acquisition priorities. The land running parallel to the ocean and to the left of the lake system is part of the Pacific Shores subdivision. You can see in this photo. The Pacific Shores subdivision consists of 1,535 lots, each approximately 1/2 acre in size. Next slide. This 2002 aerial photo from the Coastal Records Project website is looking generally to the east and provides another view of the Pacific Shores subdivision looking from the ocean with Lake Earl in the background. From this angle, we cannot clearly see respondents' property, but is located approximately here, where the white arrow is. The Pacific Shores subdivision was created in 1963, but has never been developed. It does not have municipal water or sewage systems, which are required to support new development under the Coastal Act. The area is subject to seasonal inundation, and roads and properties throughout the area can become flooded. As you may recall from several previous Pacific Shores Commission hearing items, when the Coastal Commission initially certified the Del Norte County Local Coastal Program in 81, the Commission and County agreed that this subdivision would be an area of deferred certification because of the numerous potential impacts to coastal resources. For example, development of an adequate municipal septic system for the subdivision is highly problematic, in part because the entire subdivision has very low elevation, highly permeable underlying sandy soils, and very shallow groundwater conditions. Next slide. As indicated in the staff report as Exhibit 13, this slide also shows a portion of the map provided by the State Fish and Game Department. It shows the major vegetation types in and adjacent to the Lake Earl Wildlife Area. It also illustrates all of the various sensitive habitat types in the Pacific Shores subdivision. Here is a closer view of the map with an arrow pointing at the subject property. This map identifies the property as consisting of freshwater, emergent wetland, and coastal dunes. The next few slides document the violations at issue in this matter. Next slide. The previous owner sold the property to respondents in the midst of commission staff efforts to resolve the violation. The respondents took ownership on July 3, 2007. This enforcement action is part of an overall effort to address all owners of the property and all parties responsible for the unpermitted development at the site, which includes placement of fill in and adjacent to wetlands, change in the intensity of use from a vacant lot to residential uses, removal of major vegetation, placement of a large prefabricated structure, at least 6 mobile homes or trailers, 4 to 5 vehicles, and several off-road vehicles. Staff first learned of the violations on the property in August 2006, and in this October 2006 photo, taken before respondents owned the property, you can see trailers, vehicles, and the large green prefabricated structure on the site. Note in the foreground the dune and wetlands vegetation, which indicates what the normal vegetation is in this area. Next slide. This July 5th, 2007 photo was taken not long after respondents took ownership of the property. 4 unpermitted trailers and 6 vehicles are visible, as well as the large green prefabricated structure. You can see closer in this photo the green structure. As you can see, while owned by respondents, the site has also been used for residential purposes. This is both a violation of the Coastal Act permitting requirements and the Del Norte County Health and Welfare Codes, as discussed in more detail on pages 15 through 17 of your staff report. The respondents have neither applied for nor obtained the necessary permits from the county or coastal commission. Next slide. This July 5th, 2007 photograph shows 3 more unpermitted trailer homes and fill on the subject property. All of the unpermitted development is of concern because of its potential impacts to sensitive habitat within the subdivision and in the surrounding Lake Earl Wildlife Area, which provides habitat for at least 15 federally enlisted state species, including peregrine falcon, brown pelican, western snowy plover, marbled murrelet, sand dune phacelia, Oregon silver spot butterfly, seaside hoary elfin, and greenish blue butterflies. Next slide. This September 11th, 2007 photo shows another view of the unpermitted trailers still located on the site, more fill in the areas of cleared vegetation. You can see unpermitted fill forming a driveway. A new addition to the site, which you can see if you sort of squint, is a chain strung across the driveway with a private property beware of dog sign. It's hanging from that string, which is in the middle of the photograph. There, very good. Posted in the foreground is a copy of the cease and desist and restoration orders issued by the commission to the previous owner. Next slide. The July 20, 2007 notice of intent letter to respondents cited the basis for issuance of the proposed orders. The commission has the authority to issue the proposed orders under the Coastal Act. Next slide. This slide lists the coastal resources impacted by the unpermitted development. Until appropriate restoration is undertaken, the resource damage caused by the unpermitted development continues. Next slide. As discussed on pages 21 through 30 of the staff report, under the proposed consent orders, the respondents have agreed to cease and desist from engaging in any further development, cease and desist from maintaining unpermitted development, remove the unpermitted development, allow vegetation to grow back undisturbed so that the site can return to its pre-development condition. Next slide. In conclusion, we strongly recommend that the Commission issue the proposed consent cease and desist and restoration orders to resolve the violations and to restore the wetland areas that were impacted by the unpermitted development. We'd like to again thank respondents for their efforts, and we believe that resolving these violations amicably and effectively are a good resolution for the Commission. That includes the staff presentation, and I can answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Hagee. At this time, we would call up the alleged violators or representatives if there were anyone present, but there's not. They're not here today. And we have no other speaker slips, that's correct, to speak to this item. So with that, I can close the public hearing, and I will come back to the Commission for deliberations and go to Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Commission issue cease and desist order number CCC-07-CD-07 pursuant to the staff recommendation. Recommend a yes vote.
Second.
It's been moved by Vice Chair Neely and seconded by Commissioner Akashian, and they're both asking for a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the issuance of a consent cease and desist order CCC-07-CD-07. Would you like to speak to your motion, Commissioner Neely?
I think staff covered everything well. Thank you.
Commissioner Akashian?
No, Mr. Chair.
No? Okay. Any other commissioners? If not, is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the Commission unanimously approves and hereby issues a consent cease and desist order number CCC-07-CD-07 as set forth in the staff report and adopts the findings as set forth below on the grounds that development has occurred without a coastal development permit in violation of the Coastal Act. And now we need a second motion, Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you. I move that the Commission issue restoration order number CCC-07-R0-05 pursuant to the staff recommendation.
Second.
Recommend a yes vote.
It's been moved by Vice Chair Neely, seconded by Commissioner Akashian, and both of them are recommending a yes vote for the passage of this motion will result in the issuance of a consent restoration order CC-07-RO-05. Would you like to speak to your motion, Vice Chair Neely? Commissioner Akashian?
No.
Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the Commission unanimously approves the consent restoration order CCC-07-RO-05.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That brings us to item 14, and I have, I'll be presenting these matters. I have one de minimis waiver report on the Ultramar refinery, in addition of a small modular workstation. Unless you have any questions.
Any objection to finding concurrence? Hearing none, the Commission concurs.
Then the next item I have is item 16A. And that item, we handed out an addendum to you to modify slightly a couple of the conditions that are being proposed. This is a proposal by PG&E to construct some offices and parking area at its Humboldt Bay power plant. The buildings that they're proposing to put in place are going to serve as kind of office space for a number of projects that are upcoming in the future on the area, the construction of a new power plant, the demolition of the existing plant, and decommissioning the on-site nuclear facility. The project minimizes impacts on wetlands. They made some changes that we think are obviously positive and minimizes the impacts. We have conditions to address those impacts and recommend your approval. It's my understanding that the applicant is in full agreement with the staff recommendation. I would have moved this to consent, except we did have the addendum here today. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I've completed my report.
Okay, thank you. Ex parties, starting to my left, any? All right, none? Open up the public hearing very quickly. I guess, Mr. Mullen, you're just here available for questions. I just wanted to verify that.
Yes, just for questions.
Thank you. I'll close the public hearing. go back to the commission for deliberation. Vice Chair Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the commission approve coastal development permit E-07-005 subject to the conditions specified in the staff report and recommend a yes vote.
Second.
Been moved by Vice Chair Neely, seconded by Commissioner Potter. Both the maker and seconder are asking for a yes vote. Passage of this motion will result in the approval of the permit as condition and adoption of the following resolutions and findings as suggested in the staff report and by the staff. Would you like to speak to your motion, Vice Chair Neely? Commissioner Potter? Okay. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes roll call vote on this item? Hearing none, the commission unanimously approves a coastal development permit.
That brings us to item 17, federal consistency reports. You've got negative determinations that we've distributed. So unless there are any questions on those.
Any objection to finding concurrence? Hearing none, the commission concurs.
Okay, with that, I'm prepared to present the toll road to you now. For
that, I hope you have a headhunter.
That completes the agenda, Mr. Chairman. We do have a
number. We have speaker slips,
yes,
so we do.
And my suggestion is that you hear from those folks first, and then we go into closed session, and then we'll report out a closed session either today or tomorrow morning.
Okay, we'll do that. Thank you. Catherine Rhodes, she had to leave. She had to leave, so she couldn't stay any longer. She was going to talk about the Navy Broadway complex, and she asked me to mention it, and she'll be probably contacting most of us. Mark Massaro. Mr. Massaro. Did you want Ms. Healy to go first, Mr. Massaro, or is
yes.
it, you would? That's fine, sir. Mr. Penny Healy?
Thank you.
Aaliyah, Penny Aaliyah, please.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm Penny Aaliyah with the Sierra Club, Laguna Beach. For several years now, I've been coming before the commission to address the ongoing destruction of endangered species in Esha at the Hobo Aliso Ridge in South Laguna, an area of deferred certification of Whitehole. As you can see, a consent order for restoration of a few hundred square feet of this Whitehole area was issued on July 13, 2006. This slide represents the general area in the consent order. This would be before the denuding, this would be after the denuding. The following slides. Okay, thank you. Next slide, please. The following slides will show you the ongoing degradation of this Whitehole that is under a restoration order. The applicant in the restoration process has now gone outside of the restoration area and has continued to degrade the surrounding area with an unsupervised crew armed with chainsaws and weed whackers. Not quite the toolbox you would expect for a restoration process. There is no posting on or near the site delineating this area as a restoration area. Next, please. Please note that the crown beard that was present prior to the restoration process that began the week of September 24th, is now scraped cleared of this endangered species. Next, please. If you'll note, back in June, there was crown beard in this area. This whole area has now been scraped clean. It is nothing but barren dirt. Does this mean another violation? Certainly doesn't look like restoration to us. The Sierra Club would like to understand what accountability this applicant has. When does restoration really begin? I have passed out the Sierra Club's response letter to a Latham and Watkins letter to staff objecting to Sierra Club's involvement in this issue. We contend this was a blatant attempt to intimidate and stifle public participation in coastal resource decision-making, the fundamental mandate and goal of the Coastal Act. Mark Massaro will follow me and speak to the further degradation of this site. I am providing staff with a copy of both PowerPoint presentations that Mark and I have given today, and we do look forward to actually beginning the restoration process on this area that was approved well over a year ago. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Massara?
Honorable Chair, Commissioners, Mark Massara, Sierra Club Coastal Programs. And I wanted to just take another moment to talk to you once again about this area, the Hobo Aliso Ridge and Southern Laguna Beach, and the famous, world-famous endangered plants that live on this site, and this long, long-running violation of the Coastal Act that we've appealed to you and your staff so many times regarding. The first slide that we just went by was a very encouraging letter from your staff sent to the Athens group last May, informing them that staff had undertaken work researching this area and now was in total agreement that all of this work over all of this whole entire area is unpermitted, illegal, and they're destroying ESHA and endangered species habitat. It encouraged the Athens group to work with staff to come up with a consent order to restore all of this habitat. Well, you know, I'm not sure whether this is progress or not, but they hired a law firm, and the law firm started attacking staff for being in the collusion with Sierra Club. I mean, we're way off the track here. But needless to say, many months have gone by, and not only is there no consent order, but there's what they've done is stockpiled thousands and thousands of new sandbags, and these are just photos showing the widespread destruction of habitat that's been going on here for so long. They've stockpiled thousands and thousands of new sandbags at the site, so this is contraband at the scene of the crime, ready to place those sandbags all over this site again this winter. So, I mean, the stuff is sitting there ready to go. They're ignoring your staff. They're going to do even worse work. All of this is designed to create a subdivision in an area where there is no zoning because we've got this rare habitat, that, and this stuff has to be restored. Obviously, what they're intending to do here is someday submit an application to you to build mansions on this endangered species habitat, and we just want to clarify that we're going to get, if not a consent order, a cease and desist order to ensure that restoration of this habitat occurs before we start talking about million-dollar mansions on Hobo Aliso Ridge. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Massara. Commissioner Juan.
I have two questions of staff. There is an area that we did deal with a cease and desist. Can you tell me whether or not the terms of that cease and desist order have been complied with at this point?
I was going to ask Andrew Willis of our enforcement staff to give you a brief status report where we are.
Okay, so I'll give him, since he's going to do that, I'll give him the second question I have is that outside of the area where we have a cease and desist and order and whatever the status of that is, has there been additional destruction of habitat beyond the area of that was involved in the cease and desist? And you can include the answers in your response.
Thank you, Commissioner Juan. We are currently monitoring the implementation of the restoration order. I've been out on the site to visit with the property owners' representatives and their biologists, and also taking time to meet with the Sierra Club to hear their concerns. The order authorized removal of 31 acacia trees, and that has recently been undertaken on the site. The next step will be planting of ceanothus in that area. So the acacia has come out as approved by the order. There were measures taken, or measures provided in the order, to avoid any impacts to sensitive resources outside that area along traffic routes and so forth. We're working to make those more specific to avoid any impacts to sensitive resources. But right now, I visited the site. We'll probably need to follow up with our staff ecologists and the wildlife agencies to verify whether any crown beard has been affected outside the work area.
I'm a little concerned. This has been going on for a number of years. This cease and desist was ordered When was the original cease and desist order? It's probably 2 years ago,
yeah,
right. So the answer I get from you is kind of not a real answer. They're working on it. It's 2 years now. So I'd like to know when at least the terms of the original cease and desist are going to be resolved. And then I think this issue of damage outside the area is very serious and needs to be dealt mm-hmm. with. And either they have or they have not destroyed additional crown beer. And it would seem to me that's a pretty simple answer once you've been out there. And so I'm getting this hedging from you, and I would like to make sure that you go out there, enforce the terms of the cease and desist, and if, in fact, there's been additional resource damage, that it be dealt with in an appropriate way.
That's definitely our intent.
I think I'd like to join Commissioner Wan with that. This has been going on a long time, so I know the resources are, but whatever we can do, I think on this one we should put it up at a high priority, to whatever we can do to get some, to start enforcing what's already there, because it just keeps coming back and keeps coming back. I can remember Mr. Massar bringing this issue up and Ms. Lee have met it several times.
Could I just briefly make one note, which is the cease and desist order was pertaining to one small area where Cranbird was removed, and I think we're more optimistic than Commissioner Wan about the progress under the order for that restoration, because the acacia that Andrew was alluding to before had to be removed. It was an invasive to make room for the other. So we do see progress, albeit not as quick as we would like either. But I wanted to make the additional point, which is that a lot of the comments raised by the Sierra Club and others have to do with other violations alleged at the site, and mm-hmm. those we are separately looking at and considering the appropriate action. The first order just addressed a very small amount, and we have been attempting to get them to address some of the other violations, such as additional sandbags and other things coming to the site. And I don't want you to think that we're not taking...
Okay,
I understand that. I guess it's the frequency and the length of time and the significance of the damage that concerns us. And if, in fact, they've put additional sandbags in place that may create even more problems later on, it's something we need to deal with. I mean, it just can't continue.
Marty, I'm sorry, Commissioner Lowenthal, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a procedural question. I'm not very familiar with the process. So with the cease and desist orders, when the commission votes on them and they're issued, is there any stipulation that the violators come back quarterly with progress reports as you would have, for instance, in court proceedings?
Unfortunately, I don't have the language of this particular consent order in front of us, but typically we do have that sort of provision in there. We have them do annual reports more often than quarterly, but we have some check on the progress that's being done. And generally those timelines are not, they're set forth and agreed to in the plans that are approved under the order. So what happens is you all approve an order, and then the violator submits a plan to implement the work that's under the order. And I honestly don't know what this order provides for. I can check and get back to you.
So in this scenario, for instance, the plans that they submitted would have highlighted a timeline.
Yes.
And if they are in violation of that timeline, do you as staff bring that back to the commission, or do you handle that at the administrative level in terms of subsequent? I presume that's a violation when you're out of step with the timeline.
It is, unless there's been an extension approved, or order, so we don't clog up the system with a lot of small things. We have a provision in there for the executive director to approve extensions if they apply in writing and ask for it in advance of the deadline, so that we have some control over the quality of the work and the veracity of the request or the legitimacy. And again, I'm not sure if that happened here. Under our consent orders, we have an additional provision, which is very helpful. We typically have stipulated penalties, so that if they do miss deadlines, we can collect stipulated penalties. And that's one of the advantages to doing a consent order versus a unilateral order, where we have to go to court to collect the penalties.
And if staff and commission will just indulge me, it seems that in our new era of heightened, restricted resources, limited resources, there's tremendous opportunity for applicants who are looking to game the system to do just that, which is take advantage of the fact that you have limited time and limited resources. And so there's a lot of gaming going on, and I'd like some advice, perhaps other commissioners know better, but some advice on how we can systematically ensure that that doesn't occur. So, for instance, on every cease and desist order, have timelines for progress reports, and should those progress reports not come through, initiate fines immediately. We have to have these things in place, otherwise we're back to where we start, and the public is never served. And so this is our new reality. We have limited resources, but I do believe we have the enforcement arm to put some systematic checks in place where, you know, I see this in the court. My husband's a Superior Court judge, and the onus is on the applicant, the violator, the criminal to come back to court as opposed to us chasing them down.
One of the, yes, and that would be a great idea. One of the things that would help is if we had administrative penalty authority under the Coastal Act, because then we would have a more ready and quick way to administer penalties and to, for the commission itself to be able to threaten. Currently, right now, to collect penalties under the Coastal Act, except stipulated penalties under a consent order, we need to go to court to obtain those.
So then the next step would be to ensure that we have stipulated penalties in every order?
In every consent order. Yeah. And I think all of our orders in the last 2 years or so have had them at least.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Lowenthal, for those comments. Robin Everett? Then Marty Benson? Scott Thomas?
Hello, my name is Robin Everett, and I represent the Sierra Club in the Stop the Toll Road campaign.
3 minutes?
Sure.
Okay.
Probably not even that. So we had originally intended to make this event a little lively for you. Sierra Club and Surf Rider had hundreds of people signed up to come here today to support protecting San Onofre State Beach. But don't worry, we'll definitely be here in San Diego in February. I would like to say on behalf of Sierra Club and those hundreds of people that had planned to be here that we wholeheartedly support staff's recommendation for denial of this road. We agree that TCA's green alignment is not environmentally sound. Running a road through mitigated parkland would set a horrible precedent and would render future negotiations between environmentalists and developers moot. Not only would it run through parkland, it would also run through a pristine watershed, which is used as a baseline for water quality by the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board. We agree with staff that there is no amount of mitigation that would make this road acceptable. State parks like San Onofre are a precious resource we cannot afford to lose. We look forward to your vote to protect the coast and San Onofre in February. Thank you.
Thank you for coming, Ms. Everett. Marty Benson? How much time, sir?
Just a couple minutes will be fine.
Fine, thank you.
Thanks for letting me speak. I'm Marty Benson with the Coalition to Save San Onofre, and I want to speak about the issues that I see as the more holistic, overarching issues that aren't necessarily related directly to the local environmental impacts. Those have gotten a lot of treatment in the staff reports, and for me, I surf every day, and that issue specifically is furthest from my mind with this toll road issue. I see it as a bad public policy to put a toll road through a state park for a number of reasons. I drove up here from Oceanside this morning and on a freeway that was very clogged, and I was in the far left lane next to the carpool lane, and the carpool lane was going 70 miles an hour when I was going 20. Freeways jammed with cars that have one person in each car are not a symptom of too few roads. They signify a history of too many. And so what we've seen is that the demand of motorists will rise to the supply of roads. So new major arteries in coastal California, which is highly densely populated, is a bad idea in general. Now, putting that through a state park, which is public land that's supposed to be held for conservational and recreational purposes for the public, is a huge social injustice. It's one of the few areas in Southern California where there are low-priced overnight accommodations on the coast. And so basically, if you allow a toll road, the clientele of which is necessarily able to afford and willing to pay these exorbitant tolls that it costs to drive down these roads, if you allow that to go through public land, you're basically stealing from the many to give to the least appropriate special interest minority that I can think of, and that's the rich who can fend for themselves. So I see this as Prince John's Toll Road. I strongly urge you to deny its transgression against our environment and our people. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Fine? Richard Fine?
Yes.
3 minutes, sir?
Yes, I'm on the public comment. And my name is Richard Fine. I'm the attorney for Marina Strand Colony 2. And I was at your meeting in San Luis Obispo where you were discussing the LCP. This is a follow-up with respect to the LCP. Since that period of time, I've had an opportunity to review, I believe it was the June 26th report of staff. And in that report, it refers to the fact that the county says or has told the Coastal Commission that it has told the developers that they are supposed to use the most advanced traffic studies and not use models. Well, in fact, I'm here to report to you that that is not the case. And in the most recent development that has been approved by the county, which is the Delray Shores development, both the DEIR and the final environmental impact report show that they use the 1991 DKS report, which is a model which shows what the traffic should be, and it shows that the traffic increases by 0.6% as distinguished by the findings in your own LCP review, which shows that the traffic, and this is going to be traffic that is going to be on Lincoln Boulevard, and it shows that the traffic will increase by 29 to 30%. And basically what we have in looking at the LCP, the recommendation is to sort of leave it up to the county to use the most advanced things. And I would respectfully recommend to you that you may want to change that to put in some type of a criterion that will say that the county and the developers must use the most advanced studies, because otherwise we're going to run into exactly the same situation that we have now, where the county is not having the developers use the most advanced studies. The county is approving projects based upon old 1991 DKS traffic studies, and we end up with a traffic situation that Commissioner Juan commented about the last time that we were here. It was basically abhorrent. I don't know if that's her exact word, but she did a beautiful description of what it was like to travel down Lincoln Boulevard to try and get to the airport. And we have another thing that is occurring, and that is if you were to use actual studies, we may very well find that the cap, which I think was 2840 trips, which is down to 2750 after a certain adjustment, has in fact been exceeded at this point in time, because there is not any provision for the funding by the agencies of the subregional roads or the internal roads. I think that brings me to the end of my comments. Are there any questions?
I don't think so, sir, at this time, but thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Tom Politio? How much time, sir?
3 minutes, please.
Okay, sure.
I handed a disc over. While he's doing that, my name is Tom Politeo. I'm with the Sierra Club. I live here in San Pedro. Welcome to San Pedro Bay, the home of the twin ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. Next frame, please. In the top picture, we're looking away from San Pedro Bay towards Palos Verdes. In the bottom two pictures, we're looking toward the bay and its air pollution. All three pictures were taken 3 days ago. The top and bottom pictures are from the same location. Next picture. This shows the haze over the bay from the other side on Signal Hill looking toward the bay. The rightmost arrow shows roughly where I was standing when I took the previous three pictures. Next plate. This map shows the cancer risk caused by breathing polluted air here in Southern California based on AQMD data from their MATES 2 study in 2000. The dirtiest air by far is down in the ports where you see the 5800 indicated. Nowhere else along the California coast does environmental quality measured by air quality, noise, blight, loss of access to the coastline and habitat decrease as severely as you approach the coast as here. We've once had 3,500 acres of wetlands here, and we now have less than 35, a 95% more than a 99% decline. The environmental problems produced by the twin ports in San Pedro Bay affect low-income communities of color disproportionately compared to other communities. Here in San Pedro Bay, the two ports are the lead CEQA agencies that approve EIRs. Without exception, virtually every major EIR the ports have acted upon have been approved in spite of significant impacts with findings of overriding concerns. The ports are run as municipally owned businesses. They have a fiscal interest in their revenue sources and therefore in approving their own EIRs. This has led to a separate and unequal standard of environmental quality for San Pedro Bay neighborhoods. We believe that part of the master planning process has gone off course. Through a series of numerous amendments, most with the objective of advancing industrial operations, the plans have lost perspective of balance and use of land and have become dominated by container terminals to the near exclusion of recreation, wetlands, public access. We would like to see greater involvement by the Commission to ensure balanced use in the planning of the land in San Pedro Bay, with an eye toward alleviating our environmental justice concerns and restoring some wetland habitat in this area. In particular, we would like to see, and if a gentleman makes it here later today, some coastal access restored where people in Wilmington can actually get their toes wet in the Pacific Ocean without having to leave town. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Commissioner Burke?
You know, no one on this board enjoys talking about air quality more than I do. And I appreciate the use of the board that I sit on's data. That data happens to be a little outdated. There was a subsequent study done just 2 years ago. But the story is the same no matter whether you use 2000 data or 2005 data. And that the interesting thing is that in our bond issue, this area is a prime candidate to receive an enormous subsidy for trucking out of this harbor. In fact, I was discussing it with the chairman last night, and we expect to improve the air quality in this basin significantly in the near term. So he's right on target, but we're working on it.
Thanks, Danny. Okay. Janet Gunder.
Good morning. My name is Janet Gunter, and today I'm representing the San Pedro and Peninsula Homeowners Coalition. If possible, I'd like to get 5 minutes, and I've been deferred 3 minutes of Jody James, who has a card in as well. Is that possible? I'll lickety-split. I'll try and do as fast as I can.
We'll give you 5 minutes between you and Jody James. She's donating all her time to you. Okay?
All right. I'll talk fast.
At the public comment period, we can't go forever with everybody or we'd never get done. You know, there's a lot of speakers that request that all the time. So
I know, but think of all the people I'm keeping from coming and they would have cards in. I'm just trying to use a strategy here.
Okay, well,
it's clearly not working.
5 minutes, would that work for you then?
That hopefully, yes. I will do my best to get that in.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I would just like to begin. Somebody just gave me this morning. Here is your country. Do not let anyone take it or its glory from you. Do not let selfish men or greedy interests skim your country of its beauty, its riches, or its romance. The world and the future and your very children shall judge you accordingly as you deal with this sacred trust. And that was said by President Theodore Roosevelt. I'll move through this PowerPoint now. California Coastal Commission, by exempting the Port of Los Angeles from meeting the requirements of the Commission, has effectively abandoned its responsibility to its California stakeholders. The following slides reflect the Port of Los Angeles's failure to identify negative impacts in their pre-approved EIR process for projects. Blight through visual intrusion. Project-specific mitigation. There has been no visual aesthetic mitigation ever performed by the port. Wilmington residential area, this is four blocks from the port. Predominantly Hispanic low-income residential areas are heavily affected. Port's EIRs remain silent on these blight generators. Blight extends far beyond these children's line of sight. Visual intrusion of Wilmington's cranes extend miles beyond San Pedro and into an adjoining city, Rancho Palos Verdes and San Pedro. The wealthy in Rancho Palos Verdes and the poor of Wilmington have a right to a scenic horizon. Even higher and further away, the blight of Wilmington cranes are inescapable. A look to the south reveals the China shipping cranes protruding from the horizon in San Pedro. Cranes dominate skyline. EIRs for the many pending projects valued in the hundreds of millions will be silent as to off-port lands impacts to Rancho, Palos Verdes, San Pedro, and Wilmington. In a programmatic fashion, EIRs will be tailed with a letter of overriding consideration. There is no guarantee that any off-port lands mitigations or impacts will ever be mitigated without oversight of the Coastal Commission. And that is that. If I can quickly try and get through this. Within the last 2 years, my colleague and I appeared before this commission on another of your visits to San Pedro, articulating the very same issues that I'm bringing forward today. The issue has to do with the coastal permitting granting powers that have been handed over by this commission to the Port of LA. The port is governed by its port master plan, which lays out the future of operations at the port and is reviewed by this body, the California Coastal Commission. The commission reviews this document and then certifies it so that the port is not restrained further by process in its plans. The port's authority to issue coastal permits is dependent on the Coastal Commission's approval of the port master plan. The last amendment to the master plan approved by this commission included Energy Island as part of the Pier 400 that we see today. Since the port leased the entire Pier 400 to Maersk for a container terminal, Energy Island no longer exists. Hence, the master plan is out of date, voiding the port's authority to issue coastal development permits. It's difficult to sit here in the audience and witness folks coming up to the mic to voice their concerns about potential developments that will undermine their viewsheds and community aesthetics, while we, as port communities, are forced daily to surrender any control over our aesthetics to this mammoth industry that has controlled us. And the Coastal Commission, in our view, has failed to protect this segment of the public of the state of California. To give you an example, the enormous gantry cranes that now line our harbor very seldom are analyzed for their environmental effect. The port, with their coastal permit granting authority, is allowed to approve them without review. Approximately 4 years ago, three of these cranes were placed as replacement cranes at the TRAPAC terminal, which is located at the mouth of the community just to the east of the 110 freeway. Those cranes have caused severe view obstruction of the Vincent Thomas Bridge, which has been identified as, I quote, the gateway to the harbor and one of the most significant landmarks to both San Pedro and Wilmington. All of this without an environmental review of any kind, simply bringing the cranes into place on a self-granted coastal permit. To make the matter even more offensive, the port has produced an EIR for TRAPAC terminal expansion, and the comparison views of that terminal only take into consideration the additions of more equipment buildings with photos taken after the addition of the most offensive cranes. And then they pronounce in that EIR that crane additions now are visually negligible since bridge views have already been obliterated by these other cranes.
Ma'am.
No problem. You get my drift, I'm sure.
Yes, we do.
And
we do.
We urge you to come step forward and give us some oversight by this commission to help protect us. All these other communities, Ventura, Oceanside, Carlsbad, they all have protections from you. We don't.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Commissioner Wan.
Just for your edification, once a port, and this is part of the Coastal Act, once a port master plan has been certified, as long as the development or whatever it is they do is consistent with that port. Well, that may be your opinion, but as long as it is consistent, there is no method, no reason for this to, it to come to the commission.
Okay, wait a minute. No. You're not helping yourself with that.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Director Douglas.
Just a point of historical note. One of the trade-offs we made when we passed the 76 Coastal Act was that there would be no new ports along the California coast, and that existing ports would be permitted to expand.
That's right.
And that is, a major success to have reached that compromise, because there were plans for new ports along the coast.
Thank you.
The question of what's happening now and whether or not they're in compliance with the port master plan, I will be asking staff about that and looking into that. Because if they're not in compliance, you'll hear about it.
Thank you, Director Douglas. Thank you for those clarification comments. Mr. Pat Mullen, the last speaker. Mr. Mullen, you're going to be brief?
I'm going to be extremely brief.
That's why I called you up last.
Yeah, but he's got good news.
Yeah, hopefully good news. Thank you, Chairman Krueger and Commissioners. I just wanted to take a moment to update all of you on the progress of the public's access out on the Diablo Canyon lands. You'll recall at your meeting in July in San Luis Obispo, we opened the north ranch of Diablo Canyon to a public trail that was part of our ISFC permit condition that your commission approved in December 2004. Since that grand opening, the first couple of weeks, we had numbers that were over the maximum amount, which we expected, given the publicity around that. But since then, the trail's been operating every weekend. The numbers have not exceeded the maximum. So we've been doing some adaptive management as we've seen the issues out there with some of the public. But largely, they haven't been issues that we haven't been able to address and solve with some signage and other things. So the trail's working well. The public's out there every weekend enjoying it. Numbers are ranging between 50 and 250 on any given day. So I just thought you'd appreciate hearing about that.
That's great. I heard Commissioner Kajian's making a lot of trips with his car out there dropping people off.
I also wanted to give you a little update on the Pecho Coast Trail, and that's the trail that goes out to the lighthouse on the South Ranch. Mm-hmm. We're looking at doing a number of different things, working with your staff, and we really appreciate their help. Also with the lighthouse keepers, staff, and with the Port San Luis Harbor District. We're trying some different ideas and options to increase access out on that trail. And beginning November 1st, we're going to pilot no reservation hikes. So there'll be a set time every Saturday at 9 a.m. We'll have two hikes. People can just show up. There's not a maximum number, so hopefully the numbers will be manageable. But we'll have two types of hikes, a strenuous hike for those that don't want to spend an inordinate amount of time talking about some of the different flora and fauna, and then we'll have a slower hike for those that don't want to go as fast or strenuous and spend more time talking about some of the flora, fauna, and other features of that trail. So I just wanted to give you that update, say thanks again to your staff, Executive Director Douglas and Linda Lachlan in particular, and then also thank you for the approval on the CDP for our Humboldt project earlier today. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that's good news. And Director Douglas, is there anything else you wanted to add at all? And
no, Mr. Chairman, after your last little hint there, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Somebody's. Okay, there's somebody just handed one in, a speaker slip. Jesse Margolis? Margolis? Jesse? You're here? Thank you, sir. That's the last speaker. How much time, sir, are you requesting?
3 minutes.
You got it, sir.
Okay. I'm sorry, because Staples, their color machine broke down, both of them, and two of their black and white copying machines, so I've been sort of stranded there. My name is Jesse Marquez. I'm Executive Director, Coalition for a Safe Environment. I live at 613 North Gulf Avenue. The coalition is also located and headquartered in Wilmington. Our organization is an environmental justice organization that specializes in ports, goods, movement activities, as well as the petroleum industry. I'm speaking on a non-agenda item, and basically I'm here to provide you information on Wilmington's two wetlands proposals. They are both in the Port of Los Angeles area. Right now, and for the past several years, the Port of LA has never entertained doing any wetlands restoration or mitigation in the Wilmington community. The Wilmington community is where the Port of Los Angeles is bordered to the north. And in all the past 30 to 40 years, right now we have zero wetlands or coastlands properties, all because of the port expansion. We have identified two project locations. Last year we were blessed because two students from Cal Poly Pomona Universities found a piece of property that was approximately 112 acres that's owned by the Port of Long Beach in the city of Los Angeles, in Wilmington, in the port area, where they spent a whole semester with other classmates and professors developing a plan as to how to restore that property. It has been a oil well field, it has been a dump site, and it's classified right now as a Superfund site. Our organization has been in discussion with the Port of Long Beach with the possibility of selling that property to the Port of LA for wetlands restoration as one type of an idea. Another idea would be to have a land conservancy purchase the property and work towards a wetlands restoration. So that is one location that has about 60 color slides that are in your package. In addition to that, part of the Port of LA DAS import car parking lot, it is empty over 60% of the time of the year, and then the other 40%, it's about 50% empty. They've always stated there's never been any other good use for it except for as a parking lot, and now they propose it to be a railroad staging area, but since 2001, we've always requested that it be a wetlands restoration project. For one thing, you don't need to have an import car parking lot on what was once beachfront property, coastal tidelands property, or wetlands property. In fact, many, many acres have been available across the street. They just never chose to buy it. Right now, the Port of LA owns over 100 acres throughout Wilmington that are not on coastal properties. And so we believe that the best use for the public and for the community would be for wetlands restoration. So I have in there not as elegant a little presentation as the students did, because we don't have that capability as an organization, but there are 8 pages of description of it for your review. And so I thank you for this time. I only had time, like the copier machine broke, so I couldn't make copies for everybody, and it is extensive. But I did want to let you know that there are environmental justice communities out there that see wetlands and coastal tidelands as a very precious thing and commodity, and wherever it can be restored, it should be restored. The Port of LA and Port of Long Beach have never mitigated any wetlands restoration in Wilmington whatsoever. This is an opportunity where we've identified two lands properties for that, and I thank you very much. And I'll pass out one other little gift to you as well.
Thank you for that presentation. Thank you for coming. Okay, that was the last speaker slip. So what we're going to do is have a closed session now, and then we will have to ask everyone to leave, and then we're going to open the doors and announce what we took on during closed session. So with that, if I could ask the public, if they'd be so kind, to step outside, or if you're not interested.
Roach.
The commission held a closed session today and discussed Bredesen versus Coastal Commission, both of the lawsuits in that case, and the commission gave direction to the Attorney General's office for further proceeding. In Coastal Commission versus U.S. Department of the Navy and NRDC versus Winter, the commission received a status report from the Attorney General's office. Manchester Pacific Gateway versus Coastal Commission, the commission received a report, took no action. In Mulholland Land Company versus Coastal Commission, the Coastal Commission discussed settlement and authorized a change to the terms of the settlement.
In St. Catherine of Siena Catholic School versus Coastal Commission, the commission heard a report on the status of the litigation and took no action. In the matter of Monterey County LCP Amendment Number 107, which is Measure A, the commission authorized an additional 90-day extension of the statute of limitations to file a lawsuit challenging the commission's decision on the LCP amendment. In O'Sullivan versus City of San Diego, the commission authorized the filing of an amicus brief if the California Supreme Court grants review in that case. And then finally, the commission discussed Credowitz versus Coastal Commission, discussed the settlement there, and authorized action on that settlement. And that concludes my report of closed session.
Thank you very much, Ms. Roach, for that closed session report. Director Douglas.
Mr. Chairman, just a brief additional comment on the Pebble Beach matter. You have agreed to continue for another 90 days the statute for filing a litigation. I just wanted to report that we are making, I think, good progress in our discussions with the Pebble Beach Company. The issue of a golf course is not on the table. That doesn't mean that one day they won't come back and ask for that, but that is not what we're discussing. We're discussing potential development in areas outside the environmentally sensitive habitat areas, which I think is very constructive. So I just wanted to let you know that we are making progress, and we are trying to be transparent about it to the extent that we have anything to report. That's what I'm doing here. We're going to meet again, and hopefully we'll have more specific areas for potential development where we have agreement that we can report on at the next meeting, and then you'll be seeing something in the future, either as an LCP amendment or permit.
On behalf of all the commissioners, I think we're all happy to hear there's some progress, and we're glad it's moving along. So with that, if there's nothing else, we see everybody back at 8 in the morning. Don't forget it's 8. It was scheduled for 8 because we, you know, people are, yeah, traveling.
What came off tomorrow?
But it's on the agenda for 8 o'clock.
Yeah. What was scheduled for tomorrow? That was going to take some
time. Tomorrow is going to be a little longer than today, though, I think. And remind you about the fees. Be sure to look at those proposed fee increases.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.